Dice Hate Me.
I'm Get Louder.
And I'm Puppy Shogun.
And this is episode 62, or as we like to call it, the one about emergent gameplay. And TC's Ion Award.
TC's Ion Award. Yeah.
Or maybe, just for short, this episode should be called the one about TC.
Like I said, the state of TC.
The state of TC. So, how are you, TC? Speaking
because
of
this
the state.
TC is short for emergent gameplay.
In some foreign language, maybe, yes. And maybe in Cyrillic or something.
Yeah.
You know how that goes.
So I like this. I mean, the one about TC, that sounds great.
Yeah,
I think
sure.
This is going to be the best podcast we've ever had.
Probably so. I would think, yes. All right, so if you get better numbers than the one about naked people or the one about playing with yourself, then that would be awesome.
Yeah. There you go.
All right, so last episode on the one about whatever, episode 61, the topic of emergent gameplay came up, and I thought it would be a good idea for all of us to revisit the topic and open up for further discussion, where it has it that TC has half a notebook full of notes on the subject, so it's likely going to be me and Daryl just muttering, huh, every now and then, but it should be interesting nonetheless. However, we're not going to talk about just that, because after we talk a bit about emergent gameplay, we're not going to take up the entire podcast with it. We're going to move on to TC's experience at SaltCon, because Daryl and I were not able to attend, and it seemed like a very different but interesting convention. And he also won a certain award that makes him kind of a big deal for the next year.
For an entire year.
For an entire year. That's right. Until the next, until someone takes the crown away from you and places him on to the next queen. That sounded odd, didn't it? The next bell of the ball. How's that?
The next bell of the ball.
But first, as usual, Kickstarter. Just going to get that out of the way. We're not going to talk a ton about Kickstarter. We had a huge segment last podcast about Kickstarter. I'm really only going to mention a few things. You guys can mention whatever you want. But first of all, I'm going to absolutely mention the Dice Hate Me Games Rabbits Kickstarter. It's doing really...
What's that?
What is that? Well,
and what is Kickstarter?
Yeah. Okay, the whole podcast is going to be educating everyone on not only what Kickstarter is, but what the Rabbit Kickstarter is.
This is edutainment.
Edutainment, exactly. Currently, the Rabbit Kickstarter has until Sunday. It ends on Sunday, so not much time, about 4 days left to pledge. We have about $40,658, 850 backers even right now. Of course, you mentioned on the last podcast, hopefully most of you have heard of it by now. If not, we have six 54-card games, many of which were part of the Dice Hate Me 54-Card Challenge. So go to Kickstarter, search for Rabbits, or search for Dice Hate Me, or search for Big Games for Small Pockets. There will also be a link to this on DiceHateMe.com along with the podcast, as well as, and I'm proud to announce a little bit ahead of time, we have a guild on BGG now, finally. I know.
Wow.
I've held out for the longest time because I didn't know. It was like, you know, I used to have a link to the State of Games in a blog portion that was on BGG, and I would update it. And then it just, you know, it got to the point where I didn't know if it was worth it or not, and we had Dice Hate Me. And now I feel like it's probably good to have a guild because it's pretty interactive for the Geek All-Stars, which the guild forums have been pretty active for that. So I went ahead and formed a guild for the State of Games. So you can go to BGG, search the guilds for the State of Games. There's also a link on DiceHateMe.com with this podcast to the guild. The actual link to the guild, and I had it somewhere around here. Anyway, you can search for it. Oh, there it is. The guild number is 1903. So go to BoardGameGeek.com/guild/1903, and that will be our guild. So you can go there and comment on the podcast, leave us notes, tell us your thoughts, period. Anyway, I mentioned that because you can find links to all the cool stuff there as well as DiceHateMe.com. So go to Rabbit, go to Kickstarter, search for the Rabbits, back it. It's awesome. It's a great deal. You can get six games for $50 shipping in the U.S., $60 shipping international, and I don't know how you can beat that deal, honestly.
Yeah, and at least they were at least you know there was a bunch of games that didn't get put into the Kickstarter, so you know that you hit. This is the cream of the crop, right?
Four of the games were in the challenge, and out of 108 games, those four were selected as winners, and then we have two others one being Brewcrafters Tribal Card Game, the other one Pie Factory by Brian Fisher. But yeah, I mean, these are all top-notch games. Most of them, except for the Fittest, playable with 2 to 4 players. Usually pretty easy to play. Some are a little bit more in-depth than others. They all have a different play style. We've been doing an amazing job with working with the designers, but also just some really cool art. Daryl, you've done a couple of the games. Brian Fisher is doing the art for Pie Factory. We got Daniel Gadara, who is an illustrator, do some of the art for Isle of Trains. And then I'm doing the art for Brewcrafters Tribal Card Game. And why am I blanking on the other one? Diner, the grand prize winner. Anyway, go check it out. It's an awesome project. Please help them. These are 7 individual designers who've worked hard on their designs. You'll be supporting the design community as well as, of course, Dice Hate Me Games. So speaking of the rabbits, before we moved on to something else about Kickstarter, I wanted to mention really quickly that I posted the final map. There are delivery contracts in Isle of Trains. And the delivery contracts form, there are 6 cards, and they form an island, obviously, the Isle of Trains. Dan Keltner's original idea for the Isle of Trains was to have an island that was reminiscent of Ireland, but was probably an island that didn't exist, but had kind of Irish descendants living on it. So that was the initial design. I took it and had Daniel Gadara just make kind of a generic island that sort of might have resembled, you know, a fantasy Ireland. And so I went in and I grabbed some 6 different names of cities or towns in Ireland that were in approximate locations to the island and put them on a map. Well, I posted that on BoardGameGeek, and most people were fine, but man, the kerfluffle from the Europeans was interesting. You know, I explained that it was an homage, and I'm like, you know, we love Ireland. I love Ireland. I mean, I'm Irish, and you know, I just thought it was cool that we were given homages to those cities, but so there were quite a few people who got upset that it wasn't a direct representation of Ireland, or things didn't seem like they were possibly in the right place. So, you know,
so specifically, they were angry about where it was.
That, yeah,
how am I gonna traverse Ireland if the card game that I play has a map that is erroneous? I'm gonna play this game and then I'm gonna get lost when I'm traveling Ireland backpacking game as a map.
Well, because that was an extreme example. I mean, that guy was like, you know, it's a bad map because it's not a direct representation and so on. And I'm just like, well, this is a game. It's like, you know, we're just playing an homage. And then some people were coming in saying that they didn't understand because things seemed to be in the wrong place, but it's because south was directed toward north and north was directed toward south. Just to add, again, just more whimsy to the game and not have everybody take it super literal. And the discussion went on. Most people were having fun with the discussion. It wasn't a huge deal. But occasionally there were some people who were checking back in and saying, like, you know, well, yeah, obviously, you know, I mean, I'm just paraphrasing. Obviously, you know, you're not representing real Ireland, but, you know, I don't see the point in this. And it's just like, I want to have fun with it, but at the same time, I don't want to tick off the entire Western Europe, you know, for...
I guess so.
So Dan Keltner and I talked today, and we're going to go in and actually replace the names with kind of thematic homages to Ireland, not actual place names. So, like, we'll do Innes Wharf and Lochhaven and places like that that may sound sort of Irish. You know, it's a little bit of a compromise toward that side of the thing. I can see their point. But at the same time, I'm just like, you know, I mean, there are real places in Heartland Hauling that are not represented by the correct highways around them. So I didn't have any Americans beating down my door saying, you know, those aren't the highways that go through Eureka.
Well, Americans don't have any pride. So.
Yeah, I think you're right. Anyway, I can understand their point, and especially working with cartographers for years and managing an art department with cartographers, I can understand that some people want maps to be treated seriously, but at the same time, this is a game and it's a whimsical game. It's supposed to be adding some whimsy to it. And I didn't really see in my opinion, that it made a huge difference that they were named after real places. But that's just me. Anyway, we're going to compromise. It's not a big deal because it's not in print yet. It's not a big deal to us. We still love Ireland and we want to give it that kind of Irish flair, but we don't have to name them after real places. We'll go back in and give them, you know, nods to things that we enjoy about the Irish culture and just make it its own special island. And that's fine. But again, I wanted to bring it up because it was way bigger of a deal on BGG than it should have. Most people were just having fun with it, but there were a few people who took it very seriously. And that's okay. Yeah. I mean, that's their opinion.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's easy to change names. At least that's all you have to do.
Yeah, exactly. They said either change the name or change the map. I'm like, well, I'm not going to change the map. I've already paid the artist to do the map. Might as well just change the names. I mean, that's easy for me to do on my end. I'll just re-export the cards.
You know, just add Ville to the end of every word. Right.
Dublinville, Corkville, Killarneyville.
Well, being you're giving in to just irrational anger, I would then like to suggest that I am a huge professional coffee drinker, and there is no such thing as a red coffee bean or a green coffee bean. You would never ingest those colors. So, Viva Java.
Well, you would not ingest a red coffee bean, but there is a red coffee bean. So, and there is a green coffee bean.
But, you know, if you drank those, you would die. So, therefore, all those beans need to be redone because that game is.
I will do them all. Insult
to coffee drinkers.
Next edition of Viva Java, we'll do them all in shades of brown.
Thank you.
And okay. I don't want to get political, but there's a rainbow blend, and I'm not exactly.
You're not comfortable for that?
So I'm not comfortable with there being a rainbow blend in my game, so hopefully on the second printing we can fix that.
I'll make it a pastel blend. Anyway, let's move on. Pastel. Another discussion about Kickstarter that came up was based around Matt Riddle's posting today. I think it was today. With the news about, you know, Kickstarter campaigns. He mentioned the rabbits. He mentioned in some of his notes about Pay Dirt being on Kickstarter. We've mentioned Pay Dirt before by Crash Games and why it wasn't really doing well versus other campaigns that possibly did. And it brought up some interesting discussion in the notes. So the question was like that brought up was like, you know, why does something like Payers, and for those of you who are not familiar with Payers, was a campaign, and I can't believe none of you are not familiar with Paris, but how many people who backed that campaign. But anyway, it made over $300,000. It was nothing but, you know, a fairly simple, easy to play pub game. You know, it was marketed as a pub game. I played it this past weekend. It is definitely a pub game. It's basically the entire point of the game is to figure out a loser and not a winner. There's just one loser, and that loser buys the next round. So. But it was tied to Cheap Ass Games and James Ernest, and of course he's been doing this for years and years and years. I've been a Cheap Ass fan for a while. You know, one of the first, you know, games in college we all bought were a couple of the different Cheap Ass games because they were cheap to get and fairly easy to approach and get into.
And fun,
exactly. And that's totally fine. I was totally fine with that. The thing that most people brought up is like, you know, why does something like Pairs make $300,000 on a simple game like that? What was mentioned in the comments was something that I had not really considered because I was not familiar with the background of it. But it was also tied to the book series, The Name of the Wind. And that has a huge following. They had a lot of different levels where you could purchase different versions that had different art tied to them. So what was interesting that came up in the conversation, also Steffi and I were talking about behind the scenes today, was it seems interesting in with the context of Kickstarter that you could take a simple game like that and offer different versions with just different art and satisfy a large swath of customers that, I don't know, it's not a unique concept by any means, but it's an interesting concept in the fact that it just simply blew up because of that. Anyway, what people were saying about Pay Dirt was, despite its pedigree, the fact that it was designed by Tori Neiman, who's the designer of Alien Frontiers. The fact that Patrick's been working on the game for, you know, almost 2 years now. Daryl, you've been working on graphic design for forever. There's a lot of work that's gone into this game. It's a big game. It's a Euro. The price point does, of course, you know, affect what happens on Kickstarter. That's why comparing Pay Dirt versus Pears is that kind of apples and oranges. They're very different products. But I think what kind of came up was most people felt like they had a reason why they didn't back Pay Dirt, but they had no reason why they would not back Pears. Anyway.
It's tough to, I mean, especially with the entry-level price. I mean, what, $12?
Yeah, $12 to $15. What was it, 12? Was it really 12?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
And I'm not, you know, for me personally, I'm not a big fan of, like, James Ernst games. I mean, I think he does some good ones, but then he does a lot of bad stuff. So I also got to play Pears over the weekend, and I thought it was phenomenal. And I'm really, because of that, I didn't back it, because I'd never know if it's going to be good or not. And this is just a phenomenal game. I really liked Pears.
I don't know that I'd use the word phenomenal, but I mean, it's a fun game. It's definitely a perfectly marketed game. It is a pub game by far. I mean, it's super easy to play, but it's easy to get into. I mean, it's a little reminiscent, I will say, of a game like, let's say, No Thanks, where it's easy for somebody to get into. Well, I will say now, in my opinion, No Thanks is a phenomenal game. That's an idea of a game that is simple to get into, has simple mechanics, but yet is so infinitely replayable. It's just, in my opinion, the perfect small game. You know, Pears, I thought, is kind of in that same vein, but not honestly as good as something like No Thanks.
See, I would put it on the opposite spectrum. No Thanks is broken for me when I've played it with other people.
Really? Why?
Yeah, it takes a certain group to play No Thanks, because somebody decides that they're losing, even if they're not, and they just take all the cards. And then the game's no fun.
Well, then so you pay like, with have a bunch to kick of people. Punks.
I know, you have to kick people like that out, right? To the curb. And but like Pears.
Yeah, rule number one, don't play with people like that. How's that?
No, I know, but like some people just they get into a downward spiral and they can't come out of it, right?
Yeah.
But like I guess what I liked about Pears, and we can talk about this with emergent gameplay, because I think Pears has no emergent gameplay.
Okay.
And still is fun. I just liked the that you had that decision point every single time, and it was always tense. So, I don't know. I really enjoyed it.
I will say it did take a full game of it for me to kind of grok the full potential of each round. Like, why would I not do this versus this? But then I finally got the whole pressure luck factor and mitigation of chance and also score that you're taking. No Thanks is the same way. I mean, honestly, just to put them on the same thing, you got to play through No Thanks once, and some people just play No Thanks the first time and be like, well, why wouldn't I just take that card? And then they realize they have like 100,000 score, and then they go, oh, and they get it, you know, so.
Yeah, oh, there's cards that you take out of the game?
right, yeah, exactly.
String them all together.
Exactly, yeah. So anyway, I just thought it was an interesting discussion. If you want to join the discussion or check out more about it, go to Board Game Geek. Check out the news portion. And it was Matt Riddle's posting on the latest crowdfunding roundup. I thought it was a good discussion. It was interesting to see people's reaction as to why they backed Pears or why they possibly not backed Pay Dirt. I would recommend for everybody who's interested in finding out about Pay Dirt, it is still on Kickstarter. It does need help for funding right now, so go and check it out. And that's it.
Yep.
So, I'm just going to mention really quickly another project on Kickstarter most of you should probably check out. A lot of different publishers and gamers are involved with this project. It is called Board Games Now Blind Accessible. It's run by 64-ounce Games. And basically what they're trying to do is provide blind accessibility products for certain popular board games, and in the future, board games from, you know, independent publishers and other sorts that are out there. Most of it involves using replacement sleeves or sleeves you put over the card that have Braille on them so that blind players can be able to be involved with a game that other players could play with them, or that even, you know, a group of blind gamers can play together. So I mention that because it's kind of cool. It's an interesting concept, you know, using, you know, sleeves with printing on them for Braille to actually add that blind accessibility to existing games and not just simply a game itself, even though they do have a game they've developed for the actual campaign called Yoink that is all Braille. And it's interesting because I think it's cool. Most people have signed up to try to get that. It's just a neat concept for a campaign. So any of you out there who are interested in checking it out or backing it, just go to Kickstarter and search for Blind Accessible. And it's about the only thing that'll pop up right now. Anything you guys want to mention?
I'll just mention again that I think we mentioned it last time, the Ancient World. I got to play it at SaltCon, and
is it good?
Yeah, it's really good.
So glad because I'm backing that. It looks beautiful.
Yeah, I backed it afterwards. So So I played it once, backed it. So I mean that says something. So there you go.
Well, especially from you.
Yeah. And just really enjoyed it. Didn't know what to expect. I knew what the rules were before I came in, and I knew kind of how to play, but didn't expect it to play so smoothly and awesomely. So kudos to Ryan. It's awesome.
Well, good to hear. I'm glad that my pledge is well worth it. So go to Kickstarter, search for The Ancient World by Ryan Lockett.
Kill some Titans.
Kill some Titans. Daryl, do you have anything?
No, there's too much stuff on Kickstarter right now.
No, there's not. There are only a couple of worth back games right
just
now.
Just say Sentinel's Tactics.
Sentinel's Tactics. Well, that's the thing. I was just say, right now, it's like my bank account and my wife hate me right now because like everything that is good seemed to be like, this is the week we're going on Kickstarter.
I'm
going to
tell you what right now, guys. I am never, ever kickstarting anything in the spring again.
That was crazy.
It is nuts. March has been insane. It's been March Madness, literally. Seriously, we've had Tuscany from Stegmaier Games on there. You know, we've got the Rabbits we launched, Pay Dirt's on there, Sentinel Tactics, which of course blew up. It's been a very, very busy month on March, which I think that has actually, you know, the Rabbits have done fine. They've been received a little under what I might have expected since it was engaging the design community so heavily. And it was a huge collection of an easy way to get six really good games for a really cheap price. But that said, it's had a lot of competition. And that's fine. I mean, that's going to happen on Kickstarter. I will say that I have never launched a Kickstarter campaign in this time frame simply because I thought that it might be a busy time. And always chose, again, January or the fall, or the summer during a certain, you know, time frame during the summer. I just feel like the spring, man, it's when people just kind of like jump out there. They can probably get funding. They might be able to make Essen production. You know, it's
tax returns are coming.
Right. I mean, yeah, especially if people have tax returns coming in the mail, then they got money to spend. You know, boom, they go to Kickstarter. They can put it into it. A lot of really good products out there right now. But yeah, you're right. So, Daryl, what are you backing? You're backing, obviously, the Rabbits. And
I'm backing the Rabbits. I'm backing Pay Dirt.
Sentinel Tactics.
Sentinel's Tactics. Tuscany.
Right.
I think that's it. But that's just a lot still.
It is. I mean, I'm doing the same thing. I mean, I'm not backing the Rabbits, obviously, because I would not do that. I mean, that's...
Oh, crap. This is on here now. I didn't know it was on.
What?
Of Mice and Lemmings.
Oh, yeah, Scott Olms. Yeah, let's mention that. That's from Sprocket Games, which is Michael Fox's company. Scott Olms, it's a neat little tiny game, and it doesn't cost very much. And Scott's a good designer. He's really good with tight, small designs, I find. I mean, he's done, obviously, Kings of Aristeem, which is a very large game. But I like his smaller, more intimate designs. Matter of fact, I actually have one of his prototypes sitting over here waiting to be played that he submitted to me. But so yeah, of Mice and Lemmings.
Yeah, it's like a werewolf and saboteur smash up together. Oops. With Mice and Lemmings.
Sounds pretty good.
So interested.
Yep. So yet another one. But okay, in the next 4 days, however, I want you to remember to go on back to the Rabbits. And then.
All right. Well, wait. Hold on a second. Is there Rabbits on Kickstarter?
Yes, and Rabbits are bigger than Mice and Lemmings both. So, no, I'm just kidding. We want to support Sprocket Games, and I love Michael Fox and Scott Alms, so go check that out as well. However, in the next 4 days, go ahead and back the rabbits. Just put your money towards the rabbits, and then after they fund on Sunday, then you can figure out where to put the rest of your money. How's that?
Sounds great.
And we recommend putting it in the projects that we're backing and we've mentioned here. So go do your research, make your decision. Let's move on. So we're going to talk about emergent gameplay now. This is the portion where Daryl probably falls asleep, but hopefully he doesn't, because Daryl, we need your voice of reason during this, which is what TC mentioned. So
yeah, because this could be a huge level of nerd, game nerd that we have not reached yet on the All state
right.
of games.
Well, then allow me to start the voice of reason right now.
Okay,
I don't know what the hell emergent gameplay is. At first, I thought you guys were talking like it was like slang for emergency gameplay, and I'm thinking pandemic when you're at the last outbreak. I have no idea. And obviously, I know now, but I don't know what it is for the sake of the podcast. So, TC, what the hell are you talking about, and what are you smoking?
Well, I think this is not exactly a thing that everybody knows about, and it's not something that like you pick up game design for the first time and you go, you know what, I'm thinking about these emergent gameplay factors. It's definitely something that comes about that you think about later when you start playing more and more games and you start designing more. It's just kind of a feeling that you get from playing games that, I don't know. But you said, I guess, Chris, you put down the Wikipedia definition.
I did. I have the Wikipedia definition, and it comes from an article on jeuxvideo.com, which is a French site, and it's talking about le gameplay émergent. I don't even know if I'm really butchering that, but anyway. It says that emergent gameplay refers to complex situations in video games, board games, or tabletop role-playing games that emerge from the interaction of relatively simple game mechanics. So in the context of that, and something we mentioned on the last podcast, it is gameplay that is that comes about because it is actually facilitating more complex interaction with the gamers around the table than it has to do with the actual mechanics of the game. To
Correct.
Me,
yes.
At least in the context of board games, which is kind of what we're talking about in this context. Video games are a little bit different. I think some video games try to get that through puzzle aspects or side quests or something like that. I don't know. I'm not as versed in what it means for the video games. But
yeah, and I think it's one of those things that is more, I think, prevalent in video game like design studies, I guess, because emergent gameplay is pretty much providing like a sandbox for people to work in. Even on the Wikipedia page, it puts like the perfect game for emergent gameplay, and that's Scribblenauts.
Totally, I totally get that.
But if you haven't played, you should probably pick it up. It's on like iPhone. It might even be on Android too now, and like every system, I guess. But it's pretty much the very simple rule. Like, we're going to give you a puzzle. Like, your on-screen character is standing by a tree, and you have to get the apple out of the tree. And it just says, get the apple out of the tree. Or get the apple is your command, right? And so the puzzle is, you can type in whatever word you want, and it will make that thing appear on screen. And as long as that can help you get to the apple, it will give you... If your character gets the apple out of that situation, then you will succeed. So it's this simple idea of just get the apple, and now you could get a lumberjack to chop down. You could conjure a lumberjack; he'll chop down the tree, and you'll have an apple. You
get a ladder. You get a jetpack. You know, a rock possibly to throw it, or a slingshot. You know, all kinds of different ways to solve the same problem, but a very simple problem, but based upon the interactions of the user, in this case for video games, or in terms of board games, the actual players.
And it's the unintended consequences or the unintended or surprising solutions to that simple problem that makes it emergent. That it just all and Scribblenauts really just it invites that. It wants you to explore and just do whatever. Break the game as much as possible because that's how you succeed.
Right. Well, I mean, Scribblenauts is a hilarious example because, like, you can summon Cthulhu. I mean, and Cthulhu can go on a rampage, and then you have to, like, summon something to fight Cthulhu. I mean, it's just, it's hilarious. But it's all based around very simple parameters, but you're right. I think the key term as far as video games are concerned, and this might also apply in a small way to board games, is sandbox. You know, sandbox games are, like, for instance, SimCity, some Civ games, you know, the Sims, you know, all those types of things where you basically give people this parameter and allow them to build the game around the way they choose to. And then I think that applies to board games, not necessarily in a sand. Well, I guess you could call it a little bit of a sandbox, but I don't know. It's tough. It's a little bit. Go ahead.
I say right now that honestly sounds like every game.
Well,
which is part of the difficulty of talking about emergent gameplay and getting good and bad examples of it,
right?
Because you have.
Couldn't you just be creative on how you read or dictate the rules of a game and therefore, hey, look, I'm now being uber creative.
Well, but now, that's house ruling. That's not really emergent gameplay. That's not dependent upon the actual rules that are given from the creator themselves.
But Daryl, that's something I wanted to actually bring up a little later, because basically the idea is you're misreading the rules and playing a different game. So as a game designer or a publisher, that's something you don't want to have happen. That's something that emerges from you reading the rules, and that's a really good example of how emergent gameplay works. It's just the idea that you misread a rule and now you're playing it wrong and now the whole game's ruined. That's kind of indicative of this whole situation. It's like that's how you want to control emergent gameplay. You don't want to leave things open for interpretation so that people get confused like that.
Right, and I will talk a little bit about a tangent or a subset of that. That's not, it's a little bit an offshoot in what I kind of believe in, especially with some of the Dice Hate Me games. We introduce variants and other rules that people can use to customize their gameplay that does not break the game, that actually allows them to play the game according to the way they do, and we condone. So that we know that the game plays just as well that way, but may be a little bit different. We have a core set of rules, Heartland Hollow being the best example of that. You know, we have a core set of rules, and then within that, we introduce other variables that people can introduce to the game that allows them to customize it according to the group that they have or the way they like to choose to play that game. That's different. You know, that's not really emergent gameplay as much as it is customization or modular gameplay, in my opinion.
Exactly, and I agree with that. It's just that's allowing for some exploration, and I guess exploration is a little different than emergent gameplay.
Right.
So, I think the best idea is really because we have board games, right? I mean, shouldn't we give some good examples of emergent gameplay,
absolutely,
so that people can understand what this thing is? Because, like Daryl says, isn't that like every single game? And of course, there's going to be some of that in pretty much every single game, but a lot of them focus more on that.
Well, before we get into the discussion, let me point out that if I ever come across as an idiot or an imbecile, I'm just playing the role for the podcast.
No, you're not.
Thanks, Daryl.
You are not an imbecile or an idiot if you don't know what emergent gameplay is, because there are plenty of people who don't know what emergent gameplay is. Matter of fact, when TC brought it up last podcast, I only knew it from the periphery. So, you know, since then, I've become very educated in it, which is good, because that's what we're here for. So, again, never be afraid to ask the question. And everybody out there listening as well, with the Guild or on DiceHateMe.com, never be afraid to ask, what the heck are you talking about? So anyway, go ahead.
Exactly. So, examples, I guess, for Daryl Everyman.
Yes.
There's social games technically have a lot of try to get emergent gameplay. So I want to give examples of where social games come into play. I don't think social games are specifically emergent gameplay because they facilitate that, but they give good examples. I wrote down two examples that I thought were just very, like, they allow for so many divergent strategies still within the same framework, and I thought that was Lifeboat and Cosmic Encounter.
I would absolutely 100% agree with you that Lifeboat is emergent gameplay.
Okay, and I think Lifeboat, if for people who haven't played it, it's just basically a game where you're all in a lifeboat and you are trying to either get to the front or the back and getting supplies during the course of the game, which are cards based on where you are on the boat. And everybody has a secret agenda. They want someone to die, and they love someone and they hate someone. So you just want someone to die and you want someone to live. And there's some other little things around that. But what emerges from that is just this weird...
It's a mini social system. A mini governmental system that is constantly changing based upon alliances or suspicions, or card play. Now, the emergent part of that is that you do have to have some structure, which the cards allow and dictate that. But most of the structure, and matter of fact, you can't play it with every single group because there's some people who have to have such a rigid structure that they cannot play Lifeboat. Yeah. But yeah, absolutely. It emerges. The game emerges from these very simple subsets of rules and governances, and then the players dictate where that goes.
Yeah, it's a very simple system of just secret information, and you're trying to work towards your agenda without letting everybody specifically know that that's your agenda. So it's a very simple idea, and you could just play it completely... completely straight, but it seems to foster that feeling of just trying alternate strategies, trying to work against the strategy that you're actually going for to try to win, like trying to kill everybody that you're trying to love so that people think you're trying to kill them is just, it seems counterproductive, but that's what the kind of stuff that emerges from that game. And I felt Cosmic Encounter kind of does the same thing. It's kind of the master of just the social, specific, strictly social game. But again, it has very, I'm gonna try to get a point from attacking you, or I haven't played for a while, but basically everybody can jump in on either side to support and or hurt or help and play cards, and it becomes crazy. But it's just that idea of, hey, I can give you support, I can help you, and I can play these cards, and you either win or lose, and it just becomes this crazy game, right? Just out of that simple rule set.
And I will just simply comment that based upon that you brought Cosmic Encounter as well, I think that Cosmic Encounter does have some emergent gameplay, but I don't think it's quite the same as Lifeboat, because sometimes the decisions that are made in Cosmic Encounter are very straightforward, and there's a lot more card play in that game, so there's more structure to it.
Yeah.
There can be some emergent gameplay where, you know, there's a lot of negotiations and things going on with that, but I think that Cosmic Encounter, for the most part, especially with repeated plays, you can start understanding, like, the risks versus rewards of doing certain things. The replayability and the emergence that comes out with that game is because there's so many different factions you can play during the game, so every single game seems a little bit different.
And the interactions between the different factions and how the abilities that they use work just
right. Yeah, I would call it I would call it a mini sandbox and not quite fully emergent, simply because it's carefully constructed to create a situation in each game where you're going to have a different gameplay, and it is going to allow that negotiation, a social factor, but I feel like there are far too many cards that affect the game itself to actually call it fully emergent, in my opinion.
That's fair. We're just talking about little examples.
Yeah. No, that makes sense.
Did you have any that you were thinking about, or should I keep going on?
Oh, myself? Well, I mean, something we mentioned last podcast that was agreed upon by most people, there's some of the micro games that come out that only provide very small variances. Love Letter, I think, that has a little bit of emergent gameplay, but there's not quite as much as something like Lifeboat. Let's say The Resistance has what I like to call, I guess I like to call it metagaming more than I do emergent gaming, but it falls in that same category where Resistance has a loose structure. There are only certain cards that are played in the entire game, but the rest of it's completely dependent upon the group you're playing with. So the whole gameplay and the enjoyment of the game emerges from the group dynamic. Those are the first two, of course, that come to my mind, and it's something we mentioned on the last podcast, but I felt like it bared repeating for the purposes of this discussion.
Exactly, yeah. I think, obviously I agree with the microgames thing because it's part of my definition of microgames, but, I think the little games, they have these unexpected twists and turns. Love Letter eventually caps out, I think people will say, like, eventually the strategy runs out on Love Letter, but, it still is interesting to play afterwards because you know once you know the game, you can then it becomes a lot more bluffing, a lot more. There's an interesting metagame again going on.
Right.
Some of the other things I was thinking of, other than the microgames and this new idea to just make the game more about strategies that you may not expect to be prevalent. Simultaneous reveal games. I think these are good examples of things where a simple system, usually playing like a card or anything, at the same time creates a very interesting and complex set of occurrences that happen afterwards.
Thank you.
So, for example, I've never played this game, but I wrote down Cloud9. Because I know how the game works and basically the idea of just card play either moving forward or sabotaging within the simultaneous reveal cards. We have also Gravwell, mm-hmm. which I think that one just came out last year. Dice Hit Me yep. Game of the Year, I guess, right?
Yes, it is. and can you tell I like emergent gameplay?
Well, yeah, I think that's the thing. You can't really, like, that's where it is. It's not even just social in this case. It's the idea that everybody's playing a card at the same time. They activate at different times, and that will cause a chain reaction of events that may not have been expected.
Just to stop you for 1 second, I'll let you continue. Yeah. But that's a very fascinating example to me of emergent gameplay because you don't really have to have any sort of social game going on. It's all happening in people's heads. So when you're playing something like Gravwell, you're second guessing what the second, third, or fourth player is doing based upon what card you choose. So there are a million variables that go into that, but also a little bit of, you know, could be some bluffing and things happening. And then the gameplay, because the mechanics, again, are simple, that interaction of what you think the other player is going to play versus what you want to play then interacts on a tertiary level after the game, after the cards are actually chosen to reveal, and how the ships move.
Exactly. And I think what's cool is, and this is not a hit on Corey because I think you play the game a lot, but even him, like with just that simple set of rules, he admitted that someone came up with a rules question that he had never encountered before. Based on just the very start of the game and how the cards interacted. So just such a simple system can create so many different variables.
Complex variations, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So even after playing it 100 times, he still had situations that he had not encountered, and people were like, how do I resolve this?
Right.
So I think that's pretty interesting. The other one that I would go in that same route is Bootleggers. And the reason I bring up Bootleggers, if for people who aren't familiar with it, it's a game where it's a kind of a area control-ish area majority game where you're distilling alcohol in like during Prohibition and going to different locations with that alcohol in trucks. And they're cubes, you know, whatever. But the main thing of the game is in order you have muscle cards and you play them to the table simultaneously. And out on the board, the reason you're, you know, playing these cards or, you know, which is technically a bidding, simultaneous bidding mechanic, is because there are cards out on the table that you get to then immediately play or put into your hand. And they're special cards. They have different special abilities or just give you more influence on the table. So you have to choose which muscle cards to play at what time. And what's interesting about that game is not just the simultaneous play, which can cause all kinds of different weird things to happen, but the idea that when you get a card in that game, because of how the game is so thematic, it pushes you... there is an emergent factor of extortion that happens in that game all the time. So all of a sudden, you might get a card that will is kind of, in a normal game, kind of a take that card. Well, I'll play this and you lose $10, or you lose that truck and I get it, you know, that kind of thing. But it becomes something you just hold over people's heads. You go, oh, well, hey, guess what? I have this card that I just got. That's weird. If you pay me $1, I won't play it on you. And that comes out almost immediately as people start to realize that that's what the game's all about. It's more about extortion and making these negotiations and deals where there's there's no mention of that in the rules. It doesn't say. It says there's that you can negotiate for different. It allows for negotiation, but it doesn't give a cap to those negotiations. So it's very interesting. It allows for some open trading, but some just real interesting negotiations open up simply because of the mechanics.
So a game like. In that particular vein, again, these have social aspects, but like, you know, Nothing Personal or / Kremlin or Chicken Caesar, and all in the same vein, they have those types of emergent gameplay situations. They have much more complex systems than the previously ones mentioned were, but possibly on the same level of Bootleggers, in that there are some, you know, some more complex rules involved with what happens all the way through the game. But what really happens and it boils down to is what the players are adding to that particular situation based on extortion or bribes or table talk or whatever.
And that's totally true. I mean, some of those things are revealed to you with experience, but a lot of them might just, even after playing it 10 times, you might have something that pops out that you get an idea of what you could do. And it just because it's allowed you enough openness. The game has allowed you enough of, you know, a sandbox arena. You can now make an interesting play that you never expected before. This is the first time I've ever done it. Coup. I was playing Coup over the weekend with SaltCon, and I did something that I thought I've never done this before, and it was awesome. I was in a no-win situation, right? I had one card left, and the person to my right had Coup power. He could just kill me. And someone else at the table still had two cards. So I was going to die. So what I did was someone had just called me out, and when I took my card, I didn't look at it, and I said, I'm going to steal two coins from you. So what happened was
they knew it could possibly
be. He couldn't win if he wasn't able to coup on his turn, but I had no clue if I had the captain or not, but
and
we
neither
all
did
knew
he.
There was a captain
right.
in the middle.
Right. So it totally it didn't give any tail whatsoever.
Yeah. So
that's
it was just
awesome.
A weird, yeah. So it was a weird emergent situation where I just never would have expected thought of doing that. But then when it happened, I just was like, I'm not even going to look because then he's going to know.
One of the girls I used to work with, when we would play office games, every now and then we'd play a game like Citadels or Lifeboat or something really social. Occasionally, there would be a situation where there's a hidden roll or a card you need to look at to know what you're doing. Occasionally, she would just be like, I'm not looking. And it would blow everybody's minds. And she would run the table. And it was amazing. It was awesome. But it was just like totally insane, too, because you need one to be in that kind of situation where it's a no-win. But I think that's awesome. And that is hugely indicative of emergent gameplay because that's something you just can't do. It's like if you're playing a Euro, you're not just going to say, you know what, I don't care what my objective is, I'm just going to play. You know, yeah. I mean, you've got to have, there are so many complex machinations that factor into those decisions that are not quite the same when you're playing a game that has, again, emergent gameplay that involves the other people at the table, at least in my opinion.
And I just wanted to give one more good example, I think, of a emergent factor. Before hopefully we can get into some bad examples, because I think the bad examples really help
solidify,
pinpoint right. what some of these things are. Hopefully everybody is still awake. But yes, this is important stuff. So good example, deck building in Dominion. Dominion was the first, you know, official deck builder. And it had one specific card in the entire game that did that trashed cards. It allowed you to take cards and get rid of them from your deck.
It's the church or a chapel. The
chapel. Yeah. And if that card didn't exist in Dominion, it wouldn't be the same game. The reason being because chapel sort of solidified what deck building actually was. The ability of it is just to trash however many cards you want in your hand, and then you move on to your, and put them back in the supply, and then you move on to the next turn. But what it really stood for was the idea that a deck builder, in the sense of building your deck, is not about building a deck. It's about getting rid of cards in your deck, which blows people's minds when they first get that. And that's a huge example of something I don't think the designer first intended when he put that into the game. I don't know how he came up with the idea, but I guarantee it wasn't the first thing that he thought of.
Well, I can imagine a situation where, you know, Donald X was trying to figure out, like, what, you know, and he's been in interviews before, and he's trying to distill, like, what was the fun of Magic before you really got into something really big. It's like trying to figure out, you know, what's the coolest deck you can build, what are these different interactions you can have with cards. At the same time, the problem you run into with some Magic decks is that you run through a string of cards where you're just like, this is crap, this has nothing to do with what I'm trying to do with my game, and you want to be able to get rid of those. So I think I can say either whether he did it consciously or subconsciously, I don't know. Donald X, if you're out there listening, we'd love to have the answer, but I doubt that's going to happen. Anyway, no, it's a good question to ask. Finish what you're saying, because I have a reply to that. But
no, I just say that is that and all these abstract games where you have very simple rules and you can play them over and over again. They thrive on this emergent strategic gameplay. This idea that a strategy that was not necessarily the intention of the designer. I mean, you're just specifically trying to do a certain strategy. Deck building wasn't about getting rid of cards. It was about building your card deck. And this kind of turns it on its head, and it really, it was the thing that paved the way for the deck builders for the next 5 years. Without that strategy being there, people wouldn't be able to see that. And it's just an interesting...
I hear what you're saying on that,
yeah.
And what I'm going to respond to is Paul Owen's statements on the last podcast, because okay. I actually tend to agree a little bit with what he said, or not a little bit, but mostly with what he said in response to that portion of the emergent gameplay argument. So
exactly.
I'm going to read Paul Owen's statements, and here's exactly word for word. I'm not changing anything. He says, "Not sure if I agree with your definition of emergent gameplay. Just because a new strategy develops from repeated play doesn't make it emergent, at least in his understanding of the word," is what he said. "Dominion isn't emergent if the strategy that develops is a stable, constant strategy." He says his friend Grant Jeffrey, or Greffy, would call it a degenerate strategy if any deviation from the strategy means losing the game, which I agree with. To him, he says, "Emergent means that complexity develops from simple rules in unexpected ways. Ants exhibit emergent behavior because each individual ant operates on some pretty basic rules or algorithms, but ant colonies develop complex evolutionary behavior. So chess and Go would exemplify emergent gameplay because complex strategies and counter-strategies evolve over time, and there is no fixed pattern of gameplay." Now, we'll return to that in 1 second. I think social games might be conducive to emergent gameplay when people get to know each other and try to finesse and outthink each other. He goes on to talk about microgames and agrees that we think that microgames move in that direction. What I'd like to return to, though, is his, well, 2 points. First of all, I agree that I don't fully think that the whole deck building, Dominion, this card has to be in or you don't win, is an emergent strategy. I think it's something that was built into the game, and whether it was intended by the designer or not, in order for you to win a certain strategy with a certain set of things, to win, you need to do this. I don't think that makes it necessarily emergent. I think emergent, again, means what we talked about in the beginning, sandbox, where you can feel free to play around in that whole area, and all of a sudden, like what you did with Coup, you know, all of a sudden, you're like thinking, well, I'm going to know what situation. I haven't tried this before. I'm just going to not look at my card. Well, that's emergent gameplay, because all of a sudden, you're like, well, I haven't thought of that before, but it's not going to win every time. It's not a definitive strategy that has evolved. It's something that's simply situational you were in, where you said, like, you know what? I have nothing to lose. I'm not looking at my card. Blow minds, win. I mean, that just, you know, those types of things happen. That's what I love about social gameplay and emergent gameplay. Now, going back to what Paul said about chess and Go, chess more so than Go. Go is one of those games that's just like, holy crap. It's just, there's so many variables, but so such a simple system that I think every single game is going to be very, very different. But I will say that chess, okay, it might possibly have emergent gameplay, but if you study chess long enough, you know what winning strategy is going to work versus another particular or potential strategy. If you're a chess savant or you get really, really good at it, I don't consider chess, honestly, in my opinion, having an emergent gameplay. It's mathematical. It's procedural. It's, you know, very much you did this, reactionary. You did this, I did that. Unless I stood up in the middle of a chess match and punched somebody in the face, I'm not going to change the scope of that game. Well, I might stand up in the middle of a chess game and yell, yeah, you know, just go nuts and tear my clothes off, and that might change the scope of the game. But it doesn't have anything to do with the actual gameplay itself. It's the same thing that I talk about with Euros, where I can sit down with a bunch of people who have blinders on or only focus on the Euro mechanics, and I can just table talk them into submission. That's the same thing for this. That's not really emergent gameplay.
Well, I agree with you on there. And it's funny because I put, before seeing Paul Owen's thing, one of my things was a good and bad. I put the Dominion example as a good and bad example of emergent gameplay.
Okay, that's fair.
And so I think to your point, perfectly reasonable. The only difference, I think, between Paul's point and where I'm coming from is, I think games, no matter where you no matter what, games will have these emergent gameplay strategies that are eventually discovered, and then they are no longer emergent. They're just part of the game.
Well, would you call that? Would you give that a different definition, though?
No, see, what I define as emergent is that thing may be duplicated. You may be able to do that thing again, and it may be a perfectly valid strategy. And in chess, for example, you have all these different things, and pretty much every move has been written about. But discovering that, if you had not been aware of it, is part of that emergent thing. There are some counterintuitive examples of chess play that end up working are very strange.
So
same thing with culling your deck seems counterintuitive. But do you want to? I think we should jump into bad examples because that helps.
Yeah,
me
I think so too. Go ahead.
Solidify this because chess is has a really bad example of emergent gameplay that was completely unintended, and that is chess grandmasters. They play for a draw. They don't play to win. They play to draw. And that is completely, unintended, for sure. But it's an inevitability. It's like there are a huge amount of draws in chess. That's a bad thing, and that's an emergent gameplay factor.
It's not negative. It's not a bad thing in most instances because it's still chess is good classic game. But you're right. If you play it nth times. And it's like it's like in war games. You know, what is it that he says? The only solution to the game is not to play the game. I'm sorry for people who are fans of war games out there. They're gonna write hate mail. But basically playing tic tac toe over and over and over shuts down the system because he realizes there's no real way to win as long as everybody's paying attention. Now, tic tac toe is a microcosm of that type of system. Chess has far more variables, but
what I'm trying to convey is the idea that when a strategy in chess emerges that's counterproductive for the actual enjoyment of the game. I mean, the point of the game of chess is to win. when you change your point of chess to drawing, you are no longer playing the same game, but chess doesn't make any, it doesn't actually have any rules against that. So there's an idea of unintentional emergent gameplay where instead of playing to win, you play just to draw. And if you can play to draw, well, then you have to play all over again, at least in chess. And that's a bad example. And another, going back to Dominion, right? Dominion is a bad example of emergent gameplay because it has a dominant strategy. When you play Dominion for a while, you realize that the base set. I mean, the other sets, I don't know. Everything just gets a little crazy after a while. But the dominant strategy is just to gain more money and get rid of cards if you have the ability to. So you just continually gain money and ignore all the special abilities, which look so cool. And that's the whole point of the game, is to get these like cool, interesting combos going. But you're not doing that. You're ignoring that because the other stuff works better. That would be an emergent gameplay factor that was not intended and is a bad thing. He did not intend for everybody to just not use any of the cards that are on the table. It was definitely an intention to have those cool special abilities available. But for some reason, the game is just a little bit more weighted. I mean, it's not totally that way, so don't quote me as like saying it's broken. It's not broken. It's just it's better if you have a major choice between a cool special ability and exploring the game and just sitting back and playing the same thing over and over again. You find out after a while that probably not better to explore this.
Yeah, and that falls into the whole, well, I have X known quantity that is a plus versus I have X unknown quantity that may be a plus or a minus. You know, that's obviously, if you can get closer, you know, all the way and pare down to that X known quantity that's a plus, and you get to do that almost every turn, that's going to give you far more of an output than just like, you know, cycling through the deck and hoping that you get the card that you really want. And that again talks about the evolutionary development between like the effects of magic and building a deck and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and I think going back to magic, I think magic's a good example of bad emergent gameplay. And one of the reasons why a lot of people leave magic is because there's just new cards, and they kind of either are better than the old cards, or they negate some of the things that old cards do, or they interact in ways that they need to be banned or restricted. And that's a sign of a bad design. When you put your game out and then you have to pull back and say,
that card there does this. I need to make this card do that. Or in the whole realm of magic, if we're going to have a tournament, we have to ban X card because obviously it's better than the other.
Yeah. For example, people had. This is a crazy emergent gameplay thing. But Magic the Gathering, way back when, with Chaos Orbs, people would rip them up and throw them onto the table, killing everything that the opponent had. Because the because the card says, put it up above the table and drop it.
You know, it's like, and the interpretation of the rule. Flip. Yeah, exactly.
And so they were just like, well, I'm just going to rip up my card into tiny, tiny pieces and kill everything that's on their side. Which is perfectly within the realm of that rule. They just...
That happens exactly, and that happens sometimes in really complex rule systems. People find loopholes to them. I mean, same thing happens in Warhammer 40K. Every time a new rule system comes out, some butthead finds a loophole and shows up. Like the most recent was like, you know, the Tau army where they had their scouts all the way. The Kroot had their scouts all the way across the entire table, so nobody could deploy. Well, somebody finally found a loophole around that, and it's just like, you know, almost any system that you build, unless it's a really simple or very airtight system, has these loopholes to them. We're not going to go down that lane. That's a whole other podcast.
Well, yeah, but I'm just giving examples.
No, but that's perfect. No, I agree.
Where these bad things come from. And Magic is a good example of encouraging people to experiment with the different abilities. Sometimes they like to really control it. I mean, I'm sure Daryl could probably speak to this better. But I mean, you know, Daryl. I mean, like it, they, when they make a new set, I mean, they make strategies for the different colors, right?
Yeah, there's a thing called the pie, and so they've assigned certain key abilities and key strategies to certain colors within the pie. And the pie is, you know, the five colors of magic. So,
yeah. So
blue is control. Red's going to be burn direct damage. White is going to be gaining life and defense. And black is going to be about death and, you know, stealing life.
Yeah.
So,
right.
Yeah. And I'll go way back. I mean, I remember weird things like phasing.
Yep.
And Tempest. Yeah. Yeah. And stuff like that, where that set introduced that idea. But then after that set, it pretty much went away.
Well, every set that they've done, every block, they always try to introduce some new mechanics. And then they try to keep them as a signature as that block. And then if they're popular enough, they'll come into the core sets, which are like 4th edition, 5th edition, 6th edition, etc. And I've been in and out the game for far longer than I care to admit. But I got out recently... with the, they destroyed the game, basically. I didn't care for the planeswalkers coming in. I didn't care for the double-sided cards that they did, where it was the dumbest thing in the world. Yeah, literally a double-sided. The card had no back. It had another card on the back. So you had to have, it was like just a rules nightmare. And it's just, that's a whole different topic for another day.
No, but it's not. It's actually the perfect topic for tonight. because those are the types of things. And Magic, right there, that's what I would say. Magic tries to get around those issues by, you know, making cards restricted or banned if they find a weird infinite loop combo or something like that. Yeah. But as you can see, they try to restrict the emergent gameplay factors, the different combinations, and get people to make decks that are more tailored to the set. So if there's a lot of different combinations, so it's like if red, this set has a lot of goblins, people are supposed to make a goblin deck.
Here's what,
and they lean towards that.
Okay, and then, and here's the thing, both in, you know, being supportive and also saying that you're right about Magic. In the beginning, you know, I mean, a lot of us started way back in the beginning, but I literally started in the beginning. My first decks, my first set were alphas. I had black borders. I played. We didn't care how much we chipped. We played the crap out of that game, and we played for keeps. But my point is, with that first set, even within the first two expansions, but that exactly first set, we played rainbow decks, or we would make thematic decks of, like, you know, like the plague rat deck, you know, the wolves and elves deck. I mean, all kinds of stuff that we just kind of played around with. And for the most part, that was emergent, because that allowed us to have a sandbox of a certain set of cards that we could play around with. And for the most part, nobody was overly dominant. Now, as we continued to play, we realized that certain cards were fairly overpowerful, black lotuses, mana birds, stuff like that. But at the same time, we were able to kind of have fun with that and have fun within that particular sandbox. Now, to Magic the Gathering's defense, of course, they have a money, they have a cash cow, they want to expand, they want to keep people involved with the game. They have to continue to expand it to give them new things to play around with, a new sandbox to kind of experiment with. So Magic, where it was in the very beginning, is a very, very different creature than where it is now, because there are so many different things that it has either been, you know, had to been, you know, outlawed or you know, sent to the dregs and then revisited later, or try to introduce something new to keep people interested. In my opinion, the original Magic, to me, was kind of emergent, because I mean, a lot of us would simply buy a new pack and add it to our deck and have, you know, decks about as high as we were on the table and just draw a card and see what happened. But by playing those things, we'd also try to put together thematic decks and play and try different things. And that was emergent. So that was cool. You know, we had a good time with that. I think some of that has kind of fallen by the wayside now simply because of the competition surrounding it. Now, there are some groups, not to say, there are some groups who will take, buy a couple of decks, see what happens, and then have that kind of same kind of fun, which I do agree, it's still a good system. I think Richard Garfield had a great build with the original. It has been changed and perverted a bit since its beginning initial design. But I think the core set of cards with Magic, in my opinion, might have fit within that emergent gameplay.
Yeah, and I think that's what really just excited people about it. I just want to go down a few. I also wanted to say even Euro games can have this problem. UA Rosenberg just had that issue with Caverna, where people found, two different infinite loop combinations by cards, so you could get an infinite amount of resources.
Really?
It's not these games. It's not specific to, you know, thematic games or Ameritrash games or Euro games. It happens. And the idea of more complex games is to control that emergent gameplay, but still offer a good space to work within, but not have these issues. Some other examples of bad things. To Paul Owen's credit, he had talked about how his strategy develops to be the dominant one after repleted play. I still think that's an emergent thing. For example, I said Dominion early, a few acres of snow.
Yeah, that's what came to mind when you were starting to mention those.
Yeah, Martin Wallace's game, I mean, I'm sure he tested it a bunch, but people found a breaking point. They found a strategy that is unbeatable, or at least 99% of the situation. So there's no reason to not go for it. And in a two-player game, that's kind of disastrous for that game. You have to know how to do it and all that stuff, but it's kind of like chess. If chess had an unbeatable strategy, everyone would use it. This one's kind of fun because it's in a game called Panic Station.
Here we go.
No, and I want to talk about an unintentional consequence because I think people think about emergent gameplay. This is one of the things. Things that emerge from emergent gameplay are not always strategic things. That sometimes they become problems. They're just problems, and you got to deal with them before things happen.
Before they get out of hand, right.
Yeah, so in Panic Station, there's one aspect of the game that is really, really tough, and I think Chris will back me up on this. It's when... In the game, if you move into the same room as someone else, and it's a game where there's a person who's infected, and they're trying to infect other people, but secretly. And the way that they infect people is when you move into a room, two people have to pass cards between each other. The infected person, if they're infected, can pass an infection card to the other person. Now, I'm not going to talk about the mechanic. I think it's a little silly, but...
Yeah, the gas card...
The way that it's written in the rules is that both pass the card and look at it, and then game continues. And you might think, oh, well, that's fine. I mean, you just pass the card and you continue, and if the guy's infected, he just is infected, and if he's not, then he's not, and the game continues. And those two people are supposed to know that but not let everybody else know. The problem is it becomes absolutely... It is one of the most difficult on-the-spot moments ever.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, both players have to be stone-faced about it.
Yeah, and it's crazy. Like, you wouldn't expect... And I wouldn't... I probably would have put that into a game knowing that that Bless would you. Happen. But the first time I played it, I'd realize how crazy it is because these people... like you said, they have to be stone-faced, silent, and... They have to be, even on the first play, have to be fully aware of the rules. Because what ended up happening was Chris was very quick on these social games. So you leaned to me and said, I knew exactly what happened. Like when people pass cards, you knew exactly if someone was infected or not because they didn't look at the rule book if they got the card.
Right.
So those are like when something's that on the spot. That to me is one of those things that you need to fix before
it emerges. That starts to get into a little bit of the complexities of emergent gameplay because Battlestar actually brings that up, and we talked about that last podcast. Battlestar Galactica has the same situation in the fact that either at the beginning of the game or when you go to sleep, if you might have been passed a Cylon card, you have to tell everybody at the table and you have to have somebody governing the game that knows the game or at least a group that knows the game. To everybody, just look at your card for a little while and then hide the card. Because if you have a sideline card, you need to read it. If you don't have a sideline card, you can just be like, well, yeah, fine. Well, yeah, I'm a college. I mean, I'm part of the Galactica crew or whatever. If you have a Cylon card, you need to know exactly what you need to do to win as that Cylon. And so it takes you a little bit of study and memorizing that card because you don't want to be looking at that card again. That becomes one of those things that's difficult within that system. So you have to build a system built around that emergent gameplay that allows for that to happen. And, you know, to the credit of the group that I played Battlestar with, Brian, who was talking about the game and owned the game, he was talking about, and most of everybody who played the game were sitting around saying, like, okay, everybody take their time, look at the card, and take a moment. Same thing, honestly, when you play Werewolf for everybody, or even Resistance, where you're like, whoever's saying, okay, everybody open their eyes, give everybody a few seconds to, you know, just take a look around the table and realize who is a spy or not. You have to have those systems in place. Otherwise, it breaks the emergent gameplay because you no longer are playing the game. You simply know the outcome of that system based upon how the person reacts to that card or that system in general.
Yeah, and I think, these are things that easily can be fixed with rules notations. Or just being aware that the situation has occurred and know how to make it so that that is not... Because that is not part of the game. It's not supposed to be part of the game that you look at a card and go, crap, I'm this. And then you go, oh, crap, I shouldn't have said that. That's not part of the game. Like, you are supposed to not know immediately.
Yeah, and in my full review of Panic Station, with playing with four different game groups before I reviewed it, was that situation where you get to the point where I think about 75% of the plays that we made, you might know who would have that particular card by the way they reacted to it, or may have inadvertently said something like that because they're not fully... They have not played the game enough to know that they shouldn't react in a certain way or do something in that particular situation. Whereas other people who may have played it would automatically catch on that and it would break the game. Right. Yeah. So I kind of would agree with that, but at the same time, it's like we talk about emergent gameplay in most of the examples we've given now have been in social instances. I think that there almost needs to be another term applied to that, and it's that it's evolutionary gameplay, because if you're playing with a group that have never played the game before, they may not be obviously on the same page, but if there are several veteran players playing the game and this emergent gameplay is expected to happen and somebody's not familiar with the system, it may break the game based on that. I don't know where to draw that line.
Well, I think that's why it's confusing to deal with emergent gameplay, because it really is simply about these unexpected or surprising moments that occur from simple situations. And this is passing a card becomes such a difficult problem that you would not have expected and then has to be addressed. And like I said, that's not the end of the world. You could easily address it. It's just it has to be addressed. Another one that I was talking about that emerges from trying a game. I played the game Climbers, right. And with when you get into a multiplayer situation, it's a game where you want to be at the top of the structure. You're building a structure and moving upwards on it. It's actually three-dimensional. It looks pretty cool. But you want to be at the top of the structure after, and no one else has been able to move. Like, if everybody has to pass and they cannot move upwards, like take a step upwards, and you're the highest, you win. What emerges out of that in a multiplayer game is, if I personally can't move on my turn, I need to facilitate someone else to move. Because if I can't win now, if I help someone else to move, they can move forward on their turn, and then that person who's at the top can't win. So it becomes this. So the problem with Climbers is it becomes with like four or five players is it becomes this circular problem of everyone just keeps passing around. Oh, wait, I can't win. I'm going to put this right perfectly for you so you can move up. And then the next person, and then everyone goes around. And so this is constant, like, one person moves, so the game doesn't end. And then again, it goes around again. One person moves, then the game doesn't end. And just goes on for, like, 90 minutes when it's supposed to be a 30-minute game. That's called emergent gameplay that should be addressed. This happens, I have a Railroad Tycoon. My first time I played Railroad Tycoon, two turns from the end, I turned to someone else that was there, and I was like, dude, I'm going to build this for you. And I built a railroad for it. And if I wouldn't have done that, I would have lost. But what happened, it mutually benefited us.
Right.
And I won by 1 point, and he won by second, and then we had a little gap between everyone else. Mm-hmm. So by me helping someone else out, I kind of broke the system.
Well, to touch a little bit about that for a second, going back to your comment about Cosmic Encounter actually addresses that in an interesting way, because there, you can get in those infinite loops where you're just like, I'm going to prevent somebody from doing it. Matter of fact, the difference between like Cosmic Encounter and a game like, let's say, Munchkin, we haven't mentioned Munchkin, but
yeah,
Munchkin does.
I'm a side away from it.
I know, but I'm going to mention it because Munchkin does have some emergent gameplay based upon the card plays that come out, but is in the same vein of Cosmic Encounter because it has so many different cards that interact in different ways. Munchkin doesn't really have that checks and balances except for the fact that you're going to bash the leader every single time for like an hour and a half. Cosmic Encounter can get to the point where you might do that for a few turns, but like for instance, the Cosmic Encounter that we played at PressCon, was it last year or 2 years ago? It was a while back, but
Oh yeah.
But it was a great Cosmic Encounter game because finally I got to the point where you're just like, you know, Cosmic Encounter says you can share the victory with somebody, and they addressed that. And then in fact, I just looked at you and said, like, you know what? We can both win on this turn. And you're like, are you telling the truth? I'm like, yeah, absolutely, I'm telling the truth. Let's just win both right now. And you're like, okay. So we did, and we won. Was it you, or did I do it with Clyde?
You did it with someone else. But
it was Clyde. It was Clyde.
At the same time.
Anyway, yeah. Same thing. Anyway, I think it was Clyde, but I looked at Clyde and said, like, we can win. He was like, yeah, can we? And I was like, yeah, we can do it. And we did it, and we both revealed at the same time, and we both won.
Yeah, and but see, the game addressed it. They knew that
that was
that situation, right? So it was, yes, an emergent gameplay factor, but they had already, it was a known factor. They knew that people might want to do this.
Right.
How do we deal with a tie? Well, you tie. You don't just... Yeah,
exactly, and it's totally fine because you've shared the victory in Cosmic Encounter. That's fine because it's mostly about the experience in Cosmic Encounter anyway. But, you know, it's one of those games that kind of comes up in some of those older games that have those types of emergent gameplay situations that are dependent upon the players playing the game and they playing it in the spirit of that particular game itself. And that's, again, that goes down a whole other road that could be an entirely different podcast that doesn't necessarily relate to exactly what we're talking about. But you brought it up as far as like in the context of a bad example. There are certain ways to fix that if you really know that it might come down to that.
That's right. And I think I only have one more thing that I wanted to address that may not be specifically emergent gameplay, but for game designers out there that are listening to this or people who are playing games, just something to be aware of. There is it can be intentional by the game, but it needs to be made aware to the player, I guess. The issue of if you misrepresenting the point of the game becoming an negative emergent gameplay factor. If you find, so, for example, if the game says the person who and I'll use this example. So Steam Park, in all the flavor of the text, all the rules in the game, it gives you the impression that you will receive the most points by building up an awesome theme park and collecting riders and managing how the dirt is in your park, and whoever has the best park will win. But in actuality, the point of the game is to tactically complete strategy cards the best way possible and not worry about whether or not your steam park is really well done. It's more about the card play. And I think most people going into it are going to be confused by that because it seems a little counterproductive. But that kind of that idea emerges after a while. You realize, oh crap, there's a mechanic in this game where you put riders down onto your park rides, and they collect dirt at the end of the turn, but they also give you points. But the problem is, if you're not aware of it, though every rider that you put on your park, because of the way that adds dirt to your park and dirt's worth negative points at the end, more than one negative point at the end, actually, you can taking out a rider gives you two points, but it's essentially taking out a loan. And you don't understand that whenever you're playing the game. So taking out a loan that you can replay, that is, it's a dirt loan, but like, yeah, it's a dirty loan that you take out during the course of the game. And if you get to a certain point and you have too many riders, you can get locked into a death spiral and just lose.
Yeah, I guess I can see your point about Steam Park. I don't know. I guess I had a different experience from your play because
if you feel like you're, oh man, I'm getting ahead of the curb, you need to step back because you're not really, you should be doing other things.
As an aside to that, I mean, I got over 100 points in Steam Park and crushed mm-hmm. everybody when we played, but whether it was from veteran gameplay or whatever, I didn't read the rules. I was just taught the rules. But mm-hmm. as soon as I got those cards in my hand, I knew every single turn I needed to be making sure that I was taking advantage of those cards to the full extent because there's no negative to playing those cards usually, except for the fact that you have to have, you know, you have to be able to power it with a die, which gives you some dirt, but at the same time, you're getting points off of that plus your riders and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm.
This is kind of on the edge of emergent gameplay. This is kind of that misrepresentation in the rules of what the actual point of the game is.
This is what I'm telling, and that's I don't know. I feel like we're getting a little bit off the beaten path, but it kind of comes to a different terminology where it's evolutionary gameplay or learned gameplay versus emergent gameplay. Because again, what we talked about with chess, I don't feel like it definitely is not an emergent gameplay because it's learned gameplay. It's the more you play it, the more you learn that system, and the more you're able to do that. It's not necessarily a sandbox. It's a closed environment. And emergent gameplay goes back to all the way back to your first example of Lifeboat, to me, being a perfect example of emergent gameplay. It has a set system of how things work, but it's wide open, interpreted by how the players play that game.
Exactly. Admittedly, like I said, I mean, this is on the tail end of it, but it's just something to consider, just making sure when you're dealing with these factors of what the gameplay is going to be, making it apparent what the actual point of the game is because you do not want, like you said, evolution. You do not want to not have a player know what they're trying to accomplish or feel like they're accomplishing something and then take that away from them while they're playing your game for the first time or any game. So just making sure that there is no, So, I mean, it may be off to the side, but at the same time, it's part of this. You want the game that you're playing to be specifically about the game, and these emergent gameplay factors dominant strategies should not impede your ability to explore the system you provided, I guess.
I would agree with that.
But yeah.
All right, so I'm gonna table the conversation at that point because we could literally talk about this for hours, but there's two things I want to mention. First of all, if you have a different opinion of what emergent gameplay really means, please go to dice8men.com and comment on the podcast, or go to our guild on BGG and comment on the podcast. We absolutely want to listen to your opinion on this. We'll probably mention it on following podcasts because this is a great discussion. It's obviously a great discussion because we ran it across two podcasts. Second, I want to ask Daryl.
Huh?
Huh? What's going on? Hey. Hopefully you've been paying attention because I'm going to put you on the spot right now.
Are we recording?
Yes, we are recording. Daryl,
yeah.
In your mind,
yeah.
Based on what we just talked about,
yeah.
What to you is a good example of emergent gameplay versus a bad example of a good gameplay? I want to listen because TC and I have been doing most of the talking and you've been kind of playing the everyman right now. I'd like to hear your opinions on one example of a good emergent gameplay and one example of bad emergent gameplay.
Wow. Sorry, I'm looking at my collection here.
I'll play the Jeopardy theme during this.
Anyway, well, okay. One example of good emergent gameplay. Yeah, it's kind of a cop-out, but I'm going to go with Telestrations.
No, that's fine. That is perfect example.
That's pretty good, yeah.
It is good.
Creativity rules in that.
As a matter of fact, I'd like to bring up a really quick point about that. You mentioned, Daryl, that Telestrations is a good example of emergent gameplay. Because it is, because honestly, in my mind, most party games are a good example of those. Because all they do really is set a very loose but yet clearly defined example of how the game may be played and won by a group. But it's not always 100% dependent on winning because you're enjoying the experience. But Telestrations again is a good example, but also it doesn't have a set win condition. It's mostly based upon how much the group enjoyed it. Most party games are built around that. You know, reverse charades, there can be a certain group that wins. It's totally fine. Concept, again, has emergent gameplay because it has this defined system of trying to put, you know, icons and or rather miniatures on certain things and cubes that defines concepts based on graphics and things like that that people can kind of guess. It's a visual charades. Those types of games that are loosely defined or have a loose gameplay based upon a very simple design concept are incredibly emergent, and Telestrations is that. Now, Telestrations, again, does not have a clear winner, and that's okay, because a game doesn't have to have a winner to be fun. But I think it's a good example of that, because you're right. It's all based upon how everybody in the group contributes to that core gameplay to make it enjoyable and make it a game.
Well, if you want one with a clear winner, I mean, you could say Dixit.
I would agree. I think Dixit is hugely emergent, in my opinion. Yeah, because you have a loose scoring system. You have a specified rule state of how everybody should interact with their cards in their hands. And then you have this kind of storytelling mode. And yeah, you're right. It is emergent based upon how people interact with the card play and how they interact with each other.
Right, and then one that is a horrible example of emergent, and this is to continue the Donald X bashing, Kingdom Builder.
Wow. Okay.
I was thinking about this before we got on, and I was actually going to ask Daryl if we could talk about this, but I think I know what you're talking about, but explain for everybody else what you're talking about.
Kingdom Builder?
Yeah.
It's draw one, play that card, then play the settlements to that terrain, rinse, repeat, the scoring is set, there's not much room for creativity. I mean, you have the strategy of where you're going to place people, but there's not much room for emergency.
So you feel that it feels like there's this almost like a sandbox system where you can go on this huge map and you feel like you go anywhere, but you really can't.
You can. It's every turn is literally dictated to you by that card. I mean, that's it. It's you are trapped by the game, more or less. Your turn is dictated every turn.
So what you're saying is, in that sense, the game is not giving you an opportunity to explore the system enough, so you don't have any emergent gameplay factors, and it's not giving you even, like, that enjoyment. I guess that's what, right?
Correct.
Okay, there you go. And I think that's perfect. I mean, right, we didn't talk about, I think the hardest part is talking about strategic examples of emergent gameplay, because the social aspect, I think social games, There are some actual, I believe that there are some social games that do not have a lot of emergent gameplay, and I would actually say that Dixit is on the edge for me as far as whether or not I feel that that's emergent or just a thing. That there is not really an that the game the game's fun, it just doesn't happen to have emergent gameplay factors. You and don't
the
play it.
Gameplay factors with Dixit come into when the active player describes the card. Because you can go as creative as you want and explore.
I guess that's true. That's true.
That's where that is. So that's the exact mechanic I was thinking. So
yeah.
But King Builder doesn't have that. I mean, if you play it by the rules, you draw one, play one. And it's like I said, your turn is dictated. And Chris is probably gritting his teeth and punching like something right now, but.
No, I'm not. I'm not arguing that it's not emergent gameplay. I mean, I still don't think that it makes Kingdom Builder a bad game.
I never said the word bad game.
No, I know.
Yeah.
I'm not saying no.
It's different. It's different.
It's just
between,
different. Yeah.
Yeah, because you can Euro games, and I think Euro games, you need to control your emergent gameplay. If you have rampant emergent gameplay in your game, then it is. People do not. People who are going to play that game are not going to expect it, and they're going to be unhappy with it. And that's because they want. Because those types of games, they build on a system, and if you allow for some crazy, weird, counterproductive strategy to work in that type of game, you have this issue. Now, have you guys played Coloretto?
No, I've not. I wanted to, but I haven't.
Okay, because I just played it at SoulCon. Which we could probably lead into get away from this eventually.
We will segue in a second, yes.
Yeah, I've just played Coloretto and I found it to be super excellent. I had so much fun playing this, and I just never would have expected it because it's, you know, it's just what it is. But like Daryl said, it's, you know, you draw a card and then you play stuff based on that card. Well, in Coloretto, you draw a card and you place it in a line, or you can just take a line, and that's it. Those are the rules. And you're just trying to get points by collecting sets, and there's only six colors, so you're just collecting sets of points. And it's so good. Like,
Well, there's a reason why it's stayed around for so many years.
Well, we talk about emergent gameplay. Like, you have a choice. You really just have a simple choice. You either draw a card and place it on a line, or you take one of the lines with the cards. And since no one wants to give you, like, a gift, they don't want to just... If you have a set of, say, orange, and you're trying to work toward a set of six of them, no one wants to just give you orange. They're going to be like, okay, well, you know, it's like, here's a, you know, orange comes out, they'll put it in this line, and then the next person will put a blue in that line. And the point of the game is you score your best three sets, and everything else is negative. So if you just collect all the cards, like as many cards as possible, you're just randomly going to lose because you have too many bad cards. But the strategy is to just try to be really strong on three colors and have no other cards, which there's six suits, so you want to have none of the other three suits. And it just because everything's open information, it just opens up this crazy strategic, like, aching decisions. Every single time it comes around to you, you look at it and go, oh, I could take that, but it's a blue and it's going to be -3, but it's going to be +4. I don't know what I'm going to do. And every turn is an interesting decision where it's so simple. Just draw a card and place a card or take a line. Absolutely.
Well,
becomes this game that it shouldn't be.
I have to beg the question then, by the way, as to how something like that, which has a system which I consider, again, a bit emergent and, you know, very simple, but robust. How is that different from No Thanks, other than the fact that you've played No Thanks with a group of people that tend to be buttheads about it?
Oh, no. I think, didn't we, like, we talked about whether or not I liked it as much. <We're> talking, did I like
Okay, Pairs fair enough,
as,
fair enough.
Did I liked Pairs right. a lot, so did I like it as much as No Thanks? I think they're right around the same like for me.
Okay, all
right. But I think, right, but maybe Pairs is new. It's the new
Well, I played Pairs three times this weekend, and I don't think it's anywhere near no thanks, even though I think it's a good build. But anyway, we'll leave it at that. We'll leave it at that.
I just had so much fun.
We're not going to debate.
So much gamer vocabulary.
That's right. We're done. All right. So we're going to move on. We're done. We're going to move on because we're going to be like 2+ hours at this point. Right now, we're about 1 hour and 30 minutes into the podcast. We're going to take a small break, and we'll be right back to talk about TC's grand award and how he's now the belle of the ball for a full year at SaltCon. We'll be right back. And we're back. Okay.
Yay.
So before the break, we were talking a bit about emergent gameplay, and hopefully you guys got your fill of that. But if not, that's totally cool. If you have different opinions, go to our guild on BGG or go to DiceHateMe.com and comment on the podcast. We're going to move on to a little bit of a short segment now about TC's experience in Salt Lake. This is SaltCon, which Daryl and I were unfortunately not able to attend, but it looked really cool because it looked gorgeous from all the photos that everybody were sending.
Yeah, I mean, there's mountains, real mountains.
Yeah, I mean,
they're not these fake mountains in Appalachia.
Well, and it snowed while you guys were there. I mean,
yep, it snowed twice.
It looked like everybody there was having a great time. It looked like a good group of people. Of course, there are a ton of people in that portion of the world. We've got people coming up from Arizona, from the West Coast. We had the Tasty Minstrel crew of Michael Mendez and Seth Jaffe there. So, first, before we talk about the rest of the SaltCon, we have to address the elephant in the room, obviously. TC, you won an award.
Yeah, I won this really cool award.
Tell us about the Ion Award.
The Ion Award is the most prestigious award in the entire gaming industry.
Bigger than the Spiel des Jahres.
Yeah, Spiel des Jahres is a close second to the Ion Award. Only the most talented and up-and-coming designers get the Ion Award.
And handsome, by the way, right?
And handsome, but that is not necessarily a qualification. It just seems to occur. I don't know. The Ion Award is put on by SaltCon this year, and I don't know if it's been the same person in the past, but Dan Naylor did most of the planning and everything. You have judges from within the industry. These are judges that are part of, you know, that own major companies. So you are actually getting not only getting a cool award, but you're getting feedback from people who are actually really interested in your game.
And that's really good. Now, give us an example of like who were some of the judges.
I'm not going to say that. That's not fair.
You're not.
You can't just say, oh well, the judges were these people.
Well, why not? I mean, it's not fair.
I don't know if that's because then people could just play to them, I guess, right? I mean, next year you'd just be like,
so are they secret?
This cool game.
Here's what I want to know: are they secret before they judge?
There was when I looked on the website. That's the thing. I don't want to say it because when I looked on the website, they didn't say these are the judges.
Okay.
So they just say they're industry professionals.
Fair enough. We will
so
leave
fair
it at
enough,
that.
Right? Okay. So industry professionals.
Right.
There you go. But they're definitely people that I, two people that I already knew, and one person.
I know
that,
one of them.
I know one of them. I knew most all the judges, but at the same time, it's a little weird. So, yeah. So prestigious, or the judges were very. They owned their company, or they were advisors for the companies. And
well, let me ask you this though: are they people that are simply involved in the publishing portion, or are they retailers, or are they independent judges who may just be involved in design? Or
mostly publishers. There were one or two that are involved high level in the companies, but not
okay. Let me, with full disclosure, and I have to ask this journalistically.
Yeah.
You're signed now with Xenon Profiteer, who that's the game that designed the game design that won the Ion Award for you.
Yeah, so Xenon Profiteer won the Ion Award.
Yes. Now Eagle and Griffin signed that game.
Yes.
No one involved with Eagle and Griffin were involved in the judging process. Is that correct?
that is not true.
Oh, okay. Well, see, I have to ask that journalistically because.
Here's the thing.
Okay, go ahead.
Eagle and Griffin have been with that, so you can probably figure it out that, you know, there may be a judge from Eagle and Griffin because the last 4 years they have published the winner of the Ion Awards.
Yes, they have. Yes.
I mean,
we've got Kara Sansi, which was really the last one. Yeah, Kara Sansi was last year's winner. It was published by Eagle and Griffin. That's fine. And that's okay.
Actually, Nika was last year. But
oh,
yeah,
Nika, Kara Sansi.
Well, it was the year before.
Year before, right.
I got to meet the designer of Kara Sansi, and we played. That's who I played Colorado with. So,
okay,
yeah,
okay.
Very cool.
Well, here's an interesting question, and believe me, I'm not at all trying to put a black mark on Eagle and Griffin because they are awesome, but are those games signed before the Ion Awards are announced?
I don't know if I'm supposed to say or not. I mean, basically, okay, so
we're putting TC on the hot spot right now.
There you go. Yeah, I don't know if I'm supposed to say or not is kind of your answer already. But at the same time, in the past, there was no need to, I guess. But this year has just been surprising. I mean, I got contacted by a lot of people before the end of to be fair
for Xenon Profiteer, it's a really great game. You've been courted by a lot of people about the game. I mean, Unpub 4 introduced Xenon Profiteer to a lot of different people. Even myself, I mean, I, as Dice Ate Me Games, considered wanting to sign the game, but I didn't know that it fully fit into something that I wanted to do at the time, even though I thought it was an absolute great game. I knew it had no problem getting signed. So
yeah, and I thought, you know, it's like, and that's the thing. I figured, you know, I don't want to. It's one of those things. Like you, I always give you first pick, right? You know, that's
you
just,
do,
that's
you
do.
It's true.
But if you're
you
not,
don't
like,
need, you don't need to. But I appreciate that you do.
No. Okay. But it's just like that thing. If you're, it's either going to blow you away and you want to just do it immediately, or this case, it's really tough to like. It doesn't fit the brand, right?
Right.
I'm just going to say it that way.
Right. And for full disclosure, I signed the other game you were developing side by side with Xenon Profiteer, which is Don't Get Eated. So
yeah, exactly. So, I mean, everything works out, so it's not a problem. And I don't want to put you on the spot and have you doing Air Distillation series of games. But yeah, you know, but Ion Awards was great. I mean, I'll give you an idea of how it goes. I got there on for SaltCon. I got there on Thursday. I had to show off the game on Friday morning. Three judges came in, and they looked at Xenon, and I gave them my spiel. And four other designers did that, and we each had an hour. And well, like 45 minutes, and then 15 minutes they talked about the experience, right?
Can you say really quickly, like, what were the other finalists in your category?
I met two of them, like, standing there, but I met Adam Morgan, who was a really cool dude, who did Cecilia.
Right, I saw, and he had a great prototype.
Yeah, that looked pretty.
Yeah, and it looked really pretty, and I was watching people play it, and I kind of wanted to play it while I was sitting there. So, you know, I'm interested in that one. I just want to see how it plays, because it's kind of like a little bit of a Thurnin Taxis-level game, you know? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But the other one was like Iberion, Land of something, and Nyssa, I think that's what it was.
Okay.
Which was I think it was a little more abstract. I mean, it's all capitals. So usually abstract games have all capitals and they're five letters.
Yeah, of course.
So I just assumed that was the case. I met that guy for a little bit. So I don't really know anybody, but I just met Adam Morgan. He was the only one that was setting up early. I thought everybody'd be there, but we kind of made our own little Unpub area.
For those who don't or who are not familiar with Adam Morgan, what else has he designed?
Nothing.
Nothing is was it his first like. He lives
a few minutes away from the convention.
Okay,
so,
that's cool.
Yeah, he was just a cool dude. He didn't know that all this stuff existed, right?
And that's good.
Just was right there.
Well, that's good because it actually signifies that, you know, the Ion Awards are open to any level of designer. Whether they're fully involved in the whole, you know, the underpinnings of the board game community, or they simply have a first time design they want to enter. So.
Oh yeah, and if you know, I was completely taken back by the response from the Ion Awards. So any game designers that are out there listening, you don't have, like, I submitted to it from Pennsylvania. There was another person that submitted from in the light category from New York, and I think we were the longest ones. But I mean, it just goes to show that it's not just this; it's the eyes. I mean, obviously, I got a publishing contract, Eagle Griffin, and I got to meet Rick, who runs Eagle, and yeah, he's just he's a cool dude. So
yep, he's a good guy.
Yeah, him and his wife. I met them, and then they're cool. They're laid back. Everything seems like it's going to work out nicely, and I can't be happier with the choice. And then also just the whole award thing. I mean, it's just a huge ego boost. Currently, I'm the best game designer and the hottest in the world.
Yes,
And that title stays for a year, so it's like it's really cool. So
it's true.
If you want, I mean, I'm at Puppy Shogun on Twitter. I probably won't respond because I'm getting a ton of correspondence from people who are just trying to get me to do interviews and stuff. So
for everyone out there, for a full disclaimer, TC is acting his his secret alter ego, where, you know, he plays up his ego a little bit too much, but he's not really like that.
I don't think that's true. Worse. I mean, I won.
He's worse. Like, that's right. He's worse.
Like I said, when I won the award, this award is great. I also had, it's like I had a really good sub at Subway earlier that day. That was good too.
Well, did you get to make a speech when you accepted the award?
It would have been really funny to just take the microphone and do that, but I didn't have the balls to do that. But it would have been funny to do that. I just stood there, and then people took pictures and stuff, and that was that. It wasn't a lot of pomp and circumstance. They didn't play any music, and I didn't like promenade across the exhibitor hall. Although that would have been awesome.
Missed opportunity.
Yes, totally missed. And if there's any criticism for SaltCon, definitely should have the Ion Award parade.
Have you riding in a Corvette, you know, convertible, waving to the crowd.
Yeah, so next year I can lead it because I have to give the award to the next person, right?
Right,
so,
of course, yeah.
I'll wear a sash.
You have to have a sash and promenade out onto the runway and then hand your crown over to whoever else won, which you don't have a crown, you just have a plaque. But
yeah,
by the way, the plaque was kind of polarizing, by the way, on Twitter, because a lot of people were mentioning, like, well, actually, more than just Daryl, but, you know, two or three people were mentioning, like, why was the name of the game presented in Comic Sans, which I pointed out it was not
Comic Sans.
It's Chalkboard, by the way. Anyway.
I don't know if that's excusable.
Well, possibly, but at least it's not Comic Sans.
Not Comic Sans. It's the Siamese twin of Comic Sans. Get it right,
Daryl. It's the grittier Comic Sans, but anyway.
No, but that was funny because, honestly, I had that exact same.
Okay,
go ahead. I had that exact same conversation with Patrick Nickville. He was like, "It's Comic Sans." I'm like, "No, it's not exactly Comic Sans. It's a little bit different."
It is. It truly is. Well, those of you who are design nerds out there know it's not Comic Sans. So at least they have that going for them.
But it is still not acceptable to put any on your awards or any of your prototypes. So please do not.
To the defense of the people who made the plaque and the award.
It looks cool.
When you go, well, it does. And when you go to a specific place to get something engraved, they have a subset of typefaces that they can use. They have pretty much eradicated Comic Sans, thankfully, from the selection, but they choose alternatives that can get that kind of, you know, hey, it's a little handmade font. But anyway, that's way going down the rabbit hole. We're getting way out of the topic right now.
Use Hobo. Hobo was a better
Hobo. Oh my God. Daryl, did you just not say that? Oh my God. Anyway, Anybody out there listening right now, never put something in a hobo.
I wanted them to use cracked.
That's everyone at home is, yeah, there you go. What is it, a bleeding cowboy.
Oh, my good God.
Everyone at home is like, I got to look these fonts up later.
Oh, well, yeah, I'm sure not everybody, but there might be a few. Most people are saying, like, what the hell are they talking about? Anyway, let's get back to the point. Okay, so how many people were in competition for your particular award?
I don't know the exact number. I don't really. I know that just there was four.
Okay, in your particular round of the competition, there were four. Okay.
Yeah, in the finalists. There were four finalists. All
right.
I don't know exactly how many were in the competition.
Okay.
Same Fair thing enough. With the light competition, which actually was won by Aramini.
Stephen Aramini, right?
Aramini, which who is being picked up by Crash Games. Mm-hmm. With his game that has not was Payload, I think,
right.
And now it is
Yardmaster. Right?
But to the point of, did games get signed before the Iron Awards? How did I already know about this game and that it was? Yeah, how have I already played that a month ago? So either way, I'm just saying that for and that goes again. It's not a hit on the Ion Award. Actually, it's awesome. It's completely awesome for the game designers. I have no problem with any of those things going on. It was run really well, the competition, and everything was just very fair. People were even if people were considering games ahead of time, they were just very precise. They knew the situation, and it didn't sway their opinion on things. So
okay,
yeah, I thought it was done extremely well, and kudos to SaltCon and Dan Naylor for the convention and Ion Awards in general. I think it's just very solid, and after this year, oh my gosh, if you have a game design and you have not submitted it to the Ion Awards just for the $10 fee and you think it's worth it, just do it. I mean,
dude, seriously, the fact that it's a $10 fee is worth
everybody,
it.
Seriously, if you want to work with any publishing company on the West Coast, pretty much all of them are looking at the Ion Awards. I didn't know this going into it, but it's true. So if you have a game and you're looking at a game design, thinking about next year, it's a good time.
Okay. Got his game signed by a game company on the East Coast.
All right. Well, see what that means to me actually is that at Unpub 5 we need to have the Eon Awards for the East Coast. That's kind of what it's telling me, you know, right off the bat. Anyway,
well, we already had the Dice Hit Me Rabbit Kent Challenge, so there needs to be another.
It's true.
Next year.
I will say that, you know, that's something that. When John was running on Pub, it was kicked around, and when I'm running on Pub, it's still kicked around. It's, you know, why doesn't every January there be a contest for like the best prototype? And it's, you know, that's not the point of Unpub.
No, it's not. You're right. You bring up a good point. It's not the point of Unpub. Unpub, we want to make sure that people know that it's your opportunity to bring a game that you have in development that you want to make better. Now, the fact that there are you know, publishers and things that start showing up to Unpub now, you know, that just has become a place where they can kind of talent scout. Well, honestly, it's going to add to the value of coming to Unpub, but that should not be the core reason that you sign up for Unpub to do that on the East Coast. It's to come and make sure that you have the best design game that you can then submit to publishers either in a traditional manner or enter into other contests around the country where publishers are paying attention. I think that's an important distinction because we don't want to put that kind of pressure on people feeling like they can only come to Unpub if they have an absolutely contest-worthy submission, because that's not really the purpose.
Correct.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
So, back to the Ion Awards.
Yeah, back to the Ion Awards. Yeah, I won them.
You did, yes. And Stephen Aramini won the light. You won strategy.
I won the strategy category.
There's two categories. There's strategy and then there's light.
Yeah, right? And so, okay. I mean, no offense to Stephen, because, I mean, he did win the light. But this is strategy, so. but anyway, I had a game. I had a great time. just meeting up with everybody. I got a lot of what do you call it? Networking time. But right. for me, that's like just fun time. So right.
Well, you played a ton of games with the Tasty Minstrel crowd.
Yeah, a ton of games with Tasty Minstrel dudes. What can I say? I really like Seth. He's been on Something from Nothing, and we've done game designer hangouts since then. But just right.
for
you know,
people listening, that's Seth Jaffe.
Yeah, Seth Jaffe.
He's the designer of Eminent Domain, and he also does development for Tasty Minstrel and talent scouting for Tasty Minstrel. So
yes, and he's being paid as well now.
Yes,
so that's great. Mm-hmm. He's excellent for feedback. I mean, if you just need, he'll pick up spot on what.
He is very exuberant in his excitement for certain games. He really is.
Yes.
He loves game design. He loves games. I got to know Seth over the past couple of years. Obviously, he helped Dan Keltner in developing Isle of Trains for the Rabbit campaign on Kickstarter right now for Dice Hate Me Games. But Seth has always been somebody that constantly is involved with the board game design community. He wants to make games better. He's not simply out to tote the Tasty Minstrel line. Obviously, he's looking for good games for Tasty Minstrel. But he's just a really, I mean, he just loves games. And, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, he'd even, like, before the Ion Awards, I mean, he'd even printed out Xenon Profiteer and played it.
Yeah.
And that was just a huge help, just getting feedback already. And, kind of when I got there, Mike Mendez was kind of annoyed with him because he didn't tell him that he had played it. I think he was kind of annoyed that he didn't have a shot at getting it. But, you know, that is what it is. You snooze, you lose.
Well,
right?
TC, I will say, I mean, Michael really wants you, so.
I don't know. Whatever. We were talking about how he needs to plan his scandals out. So I like the dude. What can I say? But here, I'll go down my list really fast.
Go right ahead.
I played Harbor by Scott Alms, which is going to be a Tasty Minstrel one.
Faster.
What'd you say?
What? No.
I didn't hear anything.
Oh. But you can print and play that one on BGG. Mm-hmm. It was pretty cool. I played Rock and Roll, which they're working in development on. It's like a music game. I got to play two different other Seth Jaffe games. He calls it Eminent Domain Microcosm, but I don't know. I never know what to say about these things, whether or not they're just in development or not. So, and then another game, Alter Ego. Like an Eminent Domain micro game, and then a superhero game. I played a time travel game by Roger Hicks, which I don't know what it's called.
Oh, whatever. You have my attention, sir.
Yeah, and he's Roger Hicks is the guy that he does some of the board game news, board game Dice Tower news, along with Paul Owens.
Oh, right.
And he interviewed me for a little bit, so I could say things, I guess, about my award, my major award, the most prestigious award in game design. Also, I played Colorado, Machikoro. We played a game of Pompeii. I played Sentinels of the Multiverse twice with Phil Kilcrease from Fifth Street.
Phil's a great guy, by the way.
Yeah, and then yeah. I got to put him in that situation on Coup, which was totally awesome.
let me back you up for just 1 second. Give me your quick impressions on Machikoro, because that's really kind of the hot game of right now. It's been signed by a ton of different companies. It's going to be coming to the U.S. What did you think of Machikoro?
I would say as far as game, it's like it's way overhyped, I guess.
Okay.
Because it's a good game.
Fair enough.
But it's like not. It reminded me of like all like if you could play Settlers of Catan super fast.
That's what I've heard. Yes. That's
like it's it because it really is, and the cards are misprinted too. I mean, like they like you look at them, you're like, "Why?" Talk about emergent gameplay. You're like, "Wait, these rules." If I did actually what these cards say, it would be a little crazy. But basically, it's just roll a die on your turn, see if you get what you want. And then the next person goes, rolls the die on their turn, see what you get. And I ended up, I won, but I think I got a little lucky. But the, I don't know. You just had this situation where I went three turns in a row where in the game you can you get cards and they refer to a number. So like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, right?
Right.
And at the beginning of the game, you can only roll one die. So you only have like you want to get numbers in the low end. And then later you can unlock rolling two dice so that you can roll the higher numbers. And there's one number that's a six and it's the kind of attack number. So if someone hits a six on their turn, you know something bad's about to happen. Yep. And I didn't get any attack cards. So I had every number but six. And I went three turns in a row and rolled six each time. So I did nothing for like three rounds.
Wow.
So there is a bit of luck in the game. And yeah, it's like it's the bad part of Settlers of Catan just played over one part, one full game.
So which, in the context of Machi Koro, I think most people have agreed that it's the approachability of gameplay, but also just the experience of playing the game, because it really does have cool art. Mm-hmm. And most people are just talking about how accessible the game is in general. But if
yeah, it is an accessible. I mean, you can play really quickly. I think people will jump on board with, like, if you're new to the hobby, it's probably a good intro.
Okay.
But the problem is, I think you won't be playing it very long. So okay. maybe it's a good game for maybe like four or five plays, but I can't imagine playing like forever on it. But at the same time, it's really solid. It flows well. You can play. I mean, once you know how to play, I'm sure you can bust out a game in like 20 minutes with four players. Maybe I'm exaggerating, but it seems really fast. So it has all that going for it. It's just a little too, like, there's just not enough, like...
There's not enough meat, is what you're saying.
Well, each card does the same thing. It's just so much of cards doing all the same thing. So okay. you really don't get that, like, oh, I have this card and he has that card. And there's no kind of interaction, but... So, yeah, I mean, it's cool.
All right,
but,
so what else did you play?
Yeah. Then I got to... Oh, I played Mob Town by Danny Devine, which was the one that was just on Kickstarter from Fifth Street
right.
Games. And that was cool. I played Mendez. I played an unnamed trick-taking game. And me and Seth Jaffe both don't like trick-taking games. So he just kept forcing it on us, and we kept playing this game. We must have played it like six or seven times. And I will admit, though, it's a 16-card trick-taking game. So it goes in that.
Wow.
So it's kind of interesting. And it dips into the microgame phenomenon. And it's not about deduction. So all those things are really good. And if you like trick-taking games, this is definitely a solid entry.
I'm going to kind of interject there just a little bit. Eggs and Empires, by the way, which is coming from Matt Riddle and Ben Pinchback, the guys who did Fleet, is coming soon from Eagle and Griffin, and I played that. And if Eagle and Griffin had passed on it, I would have signed it immediately. And it is a very minimal trick-taking game, but also it has cards that have abilities, so you have to think about what card you're going to play versus what other card that's going to be played. I think it's an excellent game for the amount of cards that are in the individual ones. It plays, I think if I recall correctly, from 2 to 6. I've never played it with fewer than like 5 or 6, and it's a great game in that kind of genre. And yeah. TC, you've played it.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, Eggs and these are coming from the same, I guess, design space.
Okay.
Except
right.
with the exception that this trick-taking game from Mendez is much more. I'm going to play this card, and it has an effect, and then the next card is going to affect that card, and the next card, and so these abilities chain together.
Okay, all right.
So it's much more tight in comparison of the two games. But the maneuverability in Eggs and Empires gives you a lot more like space. And I don't feel so much like that's... I know it's a trick-taking game, but it doesn't... This one is definitely trick-taking. Eggs and Empires feels a lot more like you have a little bit more...
Well,
you can play looser. It's more... It's pubby. It's pub game style.
Eggs and Empires is... both a trick-taking game, but also a trick-avoidance game. So it combines, you know, games that you know which are trick-taking, you know, like Spades and things like that, with, let's say, like Little Devils from Stronghold. So your every single round is going to be very variable, depending upon the type of egg that comes out. If you have a negative, you don't want to win that trick, so you want to be very careful about what other people are playing. Whereas if it's a positive, or if it's hidden egg, you don't know what other people are going to be playing to try to get what's going to be going on for that particular round. So, yeah. All right, anyway.
Yeah, well, either way, Eggs and Empires is a much more approachable game, because this one is just, you get immediately hit with, oh my gosh.
Okay.
Because of the possibilities for these 16 cards are just way out of control.
All right, fair enough.
But you can control that chaos as you learn how to play. It's just, yeah. So anyway, I give it a thumbs up, but I don't really like thumbs. I don't really like trick-taking games, so I have to. I don't know where that thumb is anymore.
Well, let me ask. Go ahead. I mean, I know you have a lot on your list, but I want to ask. Like at SaltCon, first of all, what was your favorite game you played at SaltCon?
Oh, that's easy, and I'm just about to say it too. The Ancient World
from Ryan Lockett. Right, we've mentioned that before. Yeah. Okay, currently on Kickstarter.
Currently on Kickstarter, but it doesn't matter if it's on Kickstarter or not. If it was on store shelves, I would have picked it up immediately. It's just that solid. It's so cool to. I mean, not only he didn't even have the art ready for like all the Titans, like and all the Colossus people that you're fighting,
right?
But you could still feel what it was going for, and it's neat because you can take a strategy where you're going to build up your city and kind of do like a little civilization building game, but with combos. And I think one of the most unique things about the game is that no matter what you do, you always are moving forward towards some strategic goal or combination that's just interesting. So like, even if you have to take it seems like a lame action. You're like, I can't build any buildings because I don't have enough space. I need to like increase my population. You can take a spot that increases population, but even that card gives you a new special ability when you take it. So like now you get to like increase your population, which sounded like a lame action because it was just like, yay, I can lay three more buildings. But it also had something like for every green building that you have, you can also get this much income this turn. So it's like now it becomes a strategically viable thing to time when you're going to expand your civilization. So yeah. Civilization building with fighting titans. I can't. And the fighting titans thing, it actually works really well and gives you stuff. And I can't. Yeah, it's cool. I want to play it over. It was much better than Cats. I want to play it over again and again. So.
Cool.
Did
Since Seth was there, did he have a copy of Isle of Trains with him at all?
I was trying to play Isle of Trains, but he didn't bring it with him.
Well, my
and you know
God.
What? And I will say this on the podcast, since I got a little bit of time here. Tasty Minstrel had no presence at SaltCon. They live like a few miles away.
Oh yeah, on, very very on? Short. Yeah.
Come on, I'm going to say that on air. Come on, I told him in person. I was like, "What are you guys doing? You should at least have a booth. It's local to you."
Yeah, I mean, well,
plan your scandal. All right, this is your scandal now.
But I will. Yeah, but I will mention, like, we have the Escapist Con here in Durham, and you know, I'm local to that, and I have not had a booth. So there are extenuating circumstances whether you want to do it. So
whatever.
All right, but at least I'm there. Like, I will have all of my games for anybody who wants to play.
Yeah, he's there too. Okay, I guess I got to give him a pass since. Dice Hate Me also has scandals involved. But anyway, but it was cool to meet. But other than that, it was really cool. I also played Pay Dirt. Got finally a chance to play Pay Dirt. Mm-hmm. And I played Xenon Profiteer like 8 or 9 times.
Oh, every time you were tweeting, I saw like Xenon Profiteer there.
Yeah, like Mike Mendez had to play me and try to beat me at this game. So we just played 2-player games until he won. We played of my own games. I played Club Zen with the Tasty Minstrel dudes, which that was really fun. It was broken, but it was really fun. I played Rock Babies, which I haven't broken out in a long time.
Rock Babies.
Rock babies. And one that I didn't talk too much about, I didn't actually talk about this on the podcast yet, and it was the reason I made this game for this podcast when I heard about the emergent gameplay was this Death Cube game, which failed miserably at SaltCon, but it works. I made some tweaks afterwards, and now it works again, so I'm excited about this thing. I made a game based around the idea of this the research I was doing on emergent gameplay and microgames, and how you just kind of want to make a tight, focused game about things about, I don't know, not the actual gameplay, and just figuring out what people want to do, or putting them in weird situations, and just making it super tight. So, it's a really interesting game. But
and did you figure out from your gameplay at SaltCon why it didn't work?
Oh yeah, because what I did was that originally I had so much emergent gameplay. I like had a social element to it. You could give money to people if they would trade a card with you. You could do all this stuff, and you only had one choice. It's like a Angry Christmas or White Elephant game.
Oh, White Elephant. Yeah.
You have to
Dirty swap. Santa. Yeah.
You have to give away the card that's in front of you with anything on the table, and then your turn's over. And then you roll a die and see if you die. So it's just very, very specific about it's set collection game based on the roll of a die, and you can be eliminated. I got rid of the player elimination after that. But it's just an interesting, tight design, and it's silly, but it works. And what didn't work was I took some feedback, tried something based on feedback, and it just took away all the emergent gameplay. So there was just, it didn't even feel like there was a game. It just felt like you were swapping cards for no reason. And that just felt so empty. So when I revised it again, I just put that all back in. And it's just that idea of just when you have a decision to make, and it's very simple, but there's a, you don't know what exactly the person beside you is going to do based on what you do, so you want to do something else that may not be what you want to do, but yeah. So
I will mention that. Well, again, not to toot the Dice Hate Me Games horn, but I will. The Fittest faced a little bit of that when it was in contention for awards and things like that. The Fittest is one of the games that's included in the Rabbit Kickstarter. It's the one social game that I feel like has emergent gameplay because it does, it's not the only one, but it's the one that mainly does in the context of what we talked about in this podcast, that it encourages, you know, player interaction in the fact that it's beyond what you're playing that particular round, whether whatever you have in your hand versus bluffing versus anything else. I admitted it when Ryan Sunders, interviewed me about the rabbits, that what was my favorite kid. I love all of them, but The Fittest kind of fits that because it encourages that kind of emergent gameplay. Each round or each game you play is going to be different based upon what cards present themselves versus what cards you have in your hand. So it's that loose type of emergent system that I think will appeal to at least game groups that like to play that type of game. And you mentioning that makes me think of that.
Yeah, and I just, with a few tweaks, I was able to take the game in a different direction that I really like, where there is a reason. You talk about like emergent gameplay, there is a reason to want to lose so that you can gain, there's like, extra like currency in the game, and it's like you can gain that by losing a round. So if you can lose really fast, it's a good thing.
That's cool. And like mirroring that, like in The Fittest, if you choose to be like, you know, I'm not competing in this challenge whatsoever, or if you're the certain like the schemer in the game, if you don't participate in that particular challenge, you can draw a card. Cards are really the currency, because you can't draw currency unless you're not involved in that challenge, which are cards. They give you more variability based upon the types of boosts you can play for a challenge if you're in them, or the actual card event that's on the card itself. If you're the schemer, you don't really care. If you're involved with whatever's going on, if you lose that challenge, you still draw a card. So you have nothing really to lose. And that kind of adds a little bit more variability and emergent gameplay, in my mind, into the game itself. So I think that those types of games I really enjoy, because if there's an extra currency that encourages you to think about why you're playing this type of card versus just a straightforward, I need to play in this in order to win, you know, that's not really a fun challenge for me and for some gamers to get involved into a game. I like ones where you have to make those types of decisions based upon multiple currencies in the game.
Yeah, and it also just, it makes it interesting too, because you, one of the problems I had was a player elimination, and I just wanted to try doing it, but it just doesn't work as well as I like. So keeping people in, and when they get eliminated, they get this little token, like it just changes it up. Like you could get eliminated on the first turn, and that could be the best thing that could happen to you.
Right.
So it changes up the gameplay style. So yeah. Anyway, so I'm interested in how that'll shake out, but that's based on our game. But I was just really excited to meet Alf Siegert, and I saw him do a game design 101 presentation where he just went pretty much through his game design career, how he got started, and the idea of where inspiration comes from and how that can, inspiration and mechanics can go together. And Alf Siegert is definitely a very, very cool, he's an excellent speaker. And when he was done, I got a chance to like shake his hand. And then he didn't get to come back on Sunday, or else I would have got to play some games with him. But next time.
He emailed me and trying to get in touch with you, which I'm glad he was able to finally. But I wish you guys had a chance to sit down and game and talk, because Alf is one of those guys that, obviously, like, ever since I was involved with board gaming, well, at least heavily into the industry, he's one of those guys that I've loved his designs. You know, we've had him on the podcast a couple times. I've interviewed him on a couple of different occasions. And I love how he thinks about games and trying to do different things with games. I'd love to, you know, work with him professionally at some point. But I'm really glad you got a chance to really just meet him and talk to him and listen to him, to the things he has to say.
Yeah, and one of the things that he set up, which was awesome, he didn't know I was going to be there. I was hoping he was going to be there, but I didn't know how close he lived to it. So I was really happy to see him. And then he found out that I was in the competition and then won the competition. And then that I was going to be published by Eagle, which, you know, he's already been published twice and now is working on another game with them.
Right, right.
He was just really excited about that. And I guess he talked to Rick, who is, as we said earlier, just the owner of
Rick Suit.
Eagle. Yeah, Rick Suit. That's how I say it. I didn't want to say it because it has three vowels in the middle and I don't mess it up. But yeah, while I got the award, I came back down, Rick pulled me aside and was talking about Kickstarter plans, right? And he brought up he was like, you know who does our videos? And I was like, oh yeah, well, Chris Kirkman. He does the videos for Eagle Griffin. And he was like, oh, yeah, yeah. And Alf came up to me after the award, and he said, you would be crazy if you didn't work with Chris on planning some sort of crazy video for this. And I was like, well, I kind of was going to do that behind your back, but I'm glad that you said it up front. So now it looks good. So,
right,
so
right.
Yeah, Chris.
Well, I'm sure that I'll be involved in some capacity. I do appreciate the fact that I'm able to work with Eagle McGriffin and Rick and all the designers that are there. Matter of fact, Eggs and Empires, I'll be involved with the video for that. I've been talking with Matt Riddle and Ben Pinchback behind the scenes on that. I really enjoy the work that I do for them. I think that Rick and company at Eagle McGriffin, as a disclaimer, they don't support this podcast. I mean, they do. They like what we do here, but they don't give any monetary kickback. They support obviously what Dice Hate Me and the State of Games does. I mean, they have ever since the beginning, but They don't provide any monetary kickback for this, other than the fact that the professional work that I do for them, video wise, which I appreciate, but I would not, I would be completely remiss journalistically if I gave them preferential treatment based upon that. I don't. I enjoy a lot of the games that they put out. Anybody going back to DiceHateMe.com and looking at my Games of the Year awards has seen that not only Fleet, which is an Eagle and Griffin release, won DiceHateMe Game of the Year for 2012, but most of their games have been either mentioned in the finals for DiceHateMe Games of the Year or Discoverers of the Year. I think they've really done a great job of, I guess, kind of bottling Rick's enthusiasm for the industry. I think that he's done a great job with that company in capturing what board gamers as a society and as a community that we really like, likes for those types of games. I would not throw that out there just willy-nilly. As a consumer and a gamer, I love what Eagle and Griffin's doing. So,
well, I don't think people think you have a conflict of interest.
Well, I hope not, because I don't think
that is. Although, I will say this. You're going to get an awesome opportunity to sabotage the Nonprofiteers video.
Well, I could sabotage any of their videos if I wanted to. I mean, if I was really like saying, like, Eagle and Griffin, I hate those guys. I mean, as much as Rick has hired me to do all the videos for Eagle and Griffin, I could be like, you know what? I want my company to prosper more than that. I'm just going to, like, I would do a bad job on all of them. But I don't. I want to have fun, and I enjoy doing them. I enjoy working with the creative process, the designers, Rick and company. You know, flat out, I think they are really out there trying to do a good job and trying to make games that not only like hardcore gamers would like to play, but also like crossover, like what we're trying to do with DiceHateMe Games. You know, we're trying to engage audiences that may not always be involved with BGG or, you know, the core design community itself. And I really respect that. So I wanted to say that.
That was a really nice political answer.
Yeah, thank you. No, it's from the heart. It's not political.
With that said, Chris is hidden angry dice inside every Eagle and
Griffin. Yeah, I should. I totally should.
I'm looking forward to that, because that's really an awesome opportunity. Because now I can just giving me a little bit of a green light to do a little to have a little fun.
TC, we'll have some fun. Actually, what we should probably do is continue your little character you've played throughout every single video we've done. So that might be fun to do. Anyway.
Okay. It's probably out of the shadow of Chris Kirkman.
All right. So beyond this, I'm gonna try to wrap this portion up, because we need to get to Unpub News and beyond. But I want to ask you personally, since we didn't have a chance to visit SaltCon, you've mentioned a lot of people you've met and the games you played. It seemed really great from your tweets, Patrick's tweets, several people who were involved with SaltCon, Seth Jaffe, throwing out pictures and things like that about their experiences. How is SaltCon different from cons like, or bigger cons, honestly, like Origins, Gen Con, or the structure of cons like WBC and PressCon?
Well, I'm going to send Daryl the pictures, because I think the panoramic pictures I took, because I think he was thinking about the layout for Unpub for this new year.
Right.
And I think this is kind of the layout he wanted to use. At least that was the idea. Basically, what I thought was cool about the layout, just in general, was that there was exhibitors around the outside in a ring. And then there was tables, just tons of tables to play games right in the middle. So you could pick up a game from the library, or you could pick up a game from a company, and you could just go right there and start playing a game, like right in front of their booth, and they could even give you help right there, which I thought was really cool. That just opens up a whole different kind of experience. And since there was like 750 people, I think, in the end, something like that, which is a pretty good size for a con, but not crazy big. It's relatively intimate. So, as far as if I was a game designer, I could talk to every I could talk to Gamelin Games. I could go to Crash Games. I could go over to Fifth Street Games. I could go to Rick. And I could go to Red Raven Games. They're all right there. And no one, it's not a huge crowd. You can get some FaceTime. You can, you know, shake hands. And it's all people on the West Coast. And since they're already there for the ION Awards, you know that there's some major companies there looking. So, yeah, it's awesome intimate opportunity early in the year when publishers are looking for things. For me as a game designer, it was an excellent opportunity. For people who are going just to play games, man, just their library was extensive. They had all the new releases. It's not big. So, I mean, it's not going to be like Origins or Gen Con. It's definitely not in any sort of way that way. It's a small convention. So, but if you want to play games, you can play everything. So,
yeah. That's awesome. So they don't have, so at least from people out there who have attended multiple conferences, they don't have a structured competition portion like WBC or PressCon, correct?
They have there are certain events that were going on.
Right, but it's not like the overarching theme, right.
Yeah, no, it's not about, it's about playing open gaming, it's about getting games
played. And that's kind of what I'm going down to right now, is like, if you attend WBC or PressCon, you do not have to be involved in any of the competitions that are going on those particular conventions, but that's really what they're structured around. Like, WBC and PressCon have the same structure where you can enter a ticket to ride con or a ticket to ride competition that lasts for three days and get all the way down and win a plaque. But yet at the same time, you can still be involved in, you know, unpublished games, festival types of events, or just open gaming events versus like Origins or Gen Con, which even at Origins, you know, we've had competitions, and some people have competitions, you know, like over a day. But for the most part, Origins and Gen Con is mostly about, you know, open gaming and demos and things like that. Is SoftCon, honestly, like SoftCon, how was the exhibition portion of that? Actually,
exhibitors.
Yeah, what I want to bring up, and TC, you've not been to BGGCon, right?
I've not. No.
Okay. Well, BGGCon, honestly, I think encapsulates sort of all of that together. Going to it last year, we had a huge Unpub presence, which I was involved with Daryl. They had a great exhibitors hall, which was not huge, but it was good. It had Fantasy Flight, it had Stronghold, Eagle and Griffin, a lot of different places where you could exhibit games. Conquistador Games was there. I'm not going to name everybody. Obviously, Crash Games was there. There was a ton of different places that you could exhibit or at least demo games and buy them. But they also had certain competitions that were going on based upon the same structure of WBC or PressCon. Not quite as robust or as big as those two. Mm. Now, SaltCon, where would you feel like that would fall?
I would say it definitely is much more like that BGG Con experience, if that's what you're saying.
Okay.
The only thing I would say, and this is just here's the thing, go to unpub.net for the people who set up Prototype Alley this year. Please go to unpub.net. I am a designer, like, you know, and I had games with me, but we pretty much had our own little Unpub area. And it was not inside their Prototype Alley. And I would say this to them: just if you do the one downside to the event was that they had a Prototype Alley experience, right, for the designers, so they could have people play their games and get feedback. But it was just, it was away off in the corner, off. It was, you call it Prototype Alley, it felt like a dark alley. It was the dark alley where weird people are hanging out. And not to say that, like, there was weird people hanging out, but it felt like that area. So having a presence even in the main hall or out front or just someplace where people are just congregating together casually is a much more open and welcoming experience than putting people off to the side and in, like, just in an area. So, it's fun to section it off, but at the same time, it didn't feel as open and inviting as I would have liked.
Right. So you would consider like SawCon would be a convention that has a lot of great things going on for it, which obviously it does, but mm-hmm. it probably should hopefully in the future incorporate more of a dedicated area, an open area for unpublished and games that need to be play tested in that venue.
Yeah, because they have an awesome group. I mean, and that's what surprised me.
Oh, yeah, well,
me,
it's they have the, like, the Utah, I'm sorry if I'm messing up the game, but the Utah Gamers, I can't even remember the guild that's
well,
going on.
It's all right, because there's two of them, actually, that were there. There was, like, the Northern Utah, like, people had NUG shirts on, Northern Utah Gamers Guild and Game Designers Guild or something like that, and then the Utah Game Design Group.
Well, the one that I'm most familiar with is the Game Designers Guild of Utah, which is the one that Alf Siegert and Phil Kilcrease belong to, which is the one that's most well known.
Exactly, and we were playing a lot of prototypes, but you just weren't in the area that was specifically marked for prototypes. And I think it was just because it felt like, you know, we were just kind of going off into
the darkness.
And so yeah, it's. We would have probably congregated in an area, but it would just have to be a little bit more open.
Okay. So,
But we've done that, like, you know, it's like we've done that at Origins, we've done that at other places with like Unpub and stuff, and it's nice to have that open area and just know where to go and have a bustling area where people are designing games and working on game design. So, and they have such a large group that I just thought it would be like everywhere, but it wasn't as everywhere as I thought it was. So.
No, that's fair.
Yeah, there you go.
But go ahead.
Excellent convention, and yeah, I would love to go again. I don't know if I'm going to be able to go again, but it was just an awesome time.
I will say that, like, from your tweets and others that I watched, mostly because you were at SawCon, honestly, but mm-hmm. also because, you know, I really hadn't heard of the convention before you were nominated for the Ion Awards. It seemed like a neat place to be. It's obviously a beautiful place to be.
Oh, yeah. It's so good.
Yeah. I love the venue.
I'm going to miss that so much because it's just such a nice area.
It's absolutely gorgeous. That's something that would actually, I don't know. I mean, when I'm going to convention, okay, and this is going to sound a little weird, but my apologies to Columbus, Indianapolis, Lancaster, anywhere else that I go for conventions, but I don't have a problem going to those conventions and staying inside the entire time. But if I'm going to SaltCon and I see that around me, I am very, very tempted to just like say, you know, for a day, I'm going to go out and just like explore the mountains or go outside and stand in a field and look at everything. I mean, that's just.
I think I took a little more walks than. I was like, there was a Target nearby, and I'm like, I'm just going to take a walk.
That's not necessarily a bad thing, because that gets a majority of us out of the convention to go. And like, I like Gen Con because you're actually outside for, you know, some of the time going to, you know, like the food trucks and the food carts that come around. You're not inside the entire time. WBC, I love Lancaster to death. Don't get me wrong, except the fact that you can't buy alcohol at any time of the hour. But I do like WBC simply because it's very insular, and you're there, and you're going to be doing what you're doing. Press cons is very much the same way, and I love that venue. But there are some venues where you're just not going to go out and do a whole lot outside of the actual convention, and that's okay. But with SaltCon, if I'm there and I see that much beauty around me, I'm like, I'm going to be tempted not to go for a few hours just to go and explore what's around me. And I like that. But at the same time, I'm tempted to say, like, you know what, I can stay and go to something.
I know. When I got to stay an extra day, and that was awesome. It ended up being a really good thing, because then I went to the airport and then hopped on a train and went to downtown Salt Lake City and hung out for a few hours. And yeah, so it's just an experience in general. So I it's like I went downtown. There was like a crazy mall inside of some of the buildings, and there was the Mormon temple. So I saw that thing and took pictures for my mom. Just all around an excellent experience. It's something I'll remember for a long time. So,
well, I think,
and I also won an award. Did I talk about that?
I don't know. What did you?
Yeah, I won the most prestigious award in game design.
Anyway, I think that anyone who lives in that particular area, or at least within a few hours of that area, should definitely check out SaltCon, because if I was living in that area, I would certainly make sure that that's on my list to go to. Fair enough. Like, WBC is in the same area within the length of where I live, and I haven't been every single year, but I love that convention. And
yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah, and SaltCon has a lot of those same things going for it. I love the venue. I love the beauty around that venue. I think that it has a good balance of things going on, which I think that BGGCon does. I would personally urge, just based on what I saw TC talking about, or at least TC tweeting about when he was at that convention, and what he's talked about in this podcast, that if you live within a short, very short and cheap plane ride or drive or bus or train or whatever from that convention, this is a good convention to go to. It's something that a lot of smaller conventions should aspire to. And I would recommend people checking it out.
Yep.
All right. So we've talked about TC's award. I don't know. Have we talked about TC's award?
Not enough.
TC won an award?
Did he?
Yeah, it's the most prestigious award in the world for game design. and also it comes with a $1 million cash prize, which is pretty good.
Okay.
So, yeah, Unpub News?
Yeah, let's move on. Because you did not win $1 million, and if you did, I might be cutting your throat to get it. But anyway. All right, Daryl, you're on point. Unpub News.
I kind of caught me unprepared. Give me 1 second here. Unpub News.
Daryl!
I'm pulling up the upcoming event lists. Okay, so I just want to make sure I have the locations and everything right. So Unpub News, we're gearing up for PAX. That's the one huge event, which is fun. And I'm really, 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 really excited to be going next weekend. We have a fantastic booth space. If you're in open gaming, you will not be able to miss us.
Who will be there?
Me.
Okay.
I will be there. Mike Mullins will be there. And I think, Chris Kirkman
Kirkwood.
Oh yeah, and the always amazing, always fun to have around, Stephanie Straw.
Yes, the so, life of the party.
Absolutely, she'll be the booth entertainment.
Yeah, so, for sure.
So that's PAX. If you are attending PAX East, if you already have a badge, because they are sold out. And you have a prototype you want to hit on the, get on the tables, make sure you go to unpub.net and register, pick one of the days to be there and, grab a table.
What I'd like to mention though, is if you do not have a PAX badge and you live in Boston or the surrounding areas, get in touch with myself, Daryl Louder, Stephanie Straw, or Mike Mullins on Twitter or elsewhere, if you know how to contact us. And let us know when you would like to meet up for drinks, because you know what? It's Boston. We're going to be out.
Chris is buying. Because evidently he's...
Do not be spreading that rumor. But anyway, I will be glad to drink a beer with you for sure, because I love Boston. I lived in Boston for a couple of years and I love it, but...
It's Harpoon that's nearby, isn't it?
No.
No,
dude, I will go anywhere in Boston to meet somebody.
No, I know, but what's the one brewery that's right there?
Harpoon's there, yeah.
It is Harpoon.
Yeah.
All right. So so PAX is April 11th, 12th, and 13th. PAX East in Boston, Massachusetts. Like I said, really excited to be there. Short of that, we have a couple of upcoming Unpub minis. We have one at Epic Loot Games and Comics in Centerville, Ohio. Actually, it's this Saturday, April 5th. So please hit up, register for that at unpub.net. We have a Board Game Builders. They have a... It's kind of like an Unpub they're trying to start up on the West Coast. It's going to be in Santa Clara, California. And so we're kind of helping them kind of build a little base, but they want to have some Unpub players there. So, you know, once again, you can register through their site to join that. And then on May 10th, we have an Unpub mini at the esteemed Atomic Empire in Durham,
yeah.
Which is a fantastic store, especially if you're over 21.
Well, yes, because they serve beer.
Yes. Game stores should always sell beer. I'm sorry.
By the way, organized and planned by Matt Wolf, which I greatly appreciate. We mentioned him on the last podcast, but he's done a great job. He runs the game design group here in our Triangle area, and also what he's doing for Atomic Empire and taking on the reins for that is great. So, Matt, thank you very much. He can also be heard. I'm going to just plug it really quickly on the last Geek All-Stars. By the way, if you want to listen to the Geek All-Stars, Google the Geek All-Stars. I'm on the Geek All-Stars most of the time, but we have our March, I don't know what we call it, March Mayhem, I don't know what we call it, because we couldn't call it March Madness because the NCAA will sue us. But anyway, based upon the best dice game, we went down from 64 titles down to the very last title. You can find out who won that at the Geek All-Stars. So Google that.
And hey, just as a note, you know, if Danny Devine or Stephen Aramini or Joseph Kissenweather are listening, it's really easy to do an Unpub in your area in Reno. So just look at the unpub.net website and you will find information to do an Unpub in your area very easily.
Or anyone else listening.
That's as right. Well.
Daryl will tell you how to set up your own local Unpub event.
Yes.
He would be glad to.
Oh, well, yeah, shoot me an email. I'll let you know. It's very, very simple. Basically, let me know where you want to hold it, preferably in a game store. Where you want to hold it, the date, the times, and the maximum number of designers that the game store can hold, a.k.a. how many tables you have. And, with that information, and if you want to, you know, throw a quick blurb, with that information, I get it up on the site and enable registration on the back end. So it's really that simple, and then you just kind of show up and make sure everything goes according to plan. You're hosting. That's it.
Well, there you go. That's very simple. The Unpub 4 minutes with Daryl Louder. Anyway, I'm sure we'll have more Unpub news coming. Go to unpub.net to check out when the latest news blurb may happen. Daryl has like a green screen that he's been using religiously to record the Unpub news. We'll have more of that coming up towards the summer when we get into Origins, Gen Con, and etc. So make sure you go and check that out. Sign up if you have not.
If you'd like to get involved more with the conversation about the state of games or TC's Ion Award, or get more game reviews and news than you can shake a stick at, head over to DiceHateMe.com and comment on the podcast. Or you can even join the guild on BGG and let us know your thoughts. So many options.
Well, you can always find me on Twitter at DiceHateMe.
You can find me on Twitter at GetLouder.
And you can follow the North Star to find me, or you can find me at Puppy Shogun on Twitter.
Excellent. And this is all of us saying thanks for listening, and may all your rolls be sixes.
Swinging in the backyard, pull up in your fast car, whistling my name. Open up a beer and you say get over here and play a video game. I'm in his favorite sundress, watching me get undressed, take that body downtown. I say you the bestest, leaning for a big kiss, put his favorite perfume on, go play a video game. It's you, it's you, it's all for you, everything.